just think about it.
HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call, Detroit's longest running phone in talk show with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julie will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIS. 248-544-9743. Or text the riff at 4WRIF. That's 49743. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julie Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone.
Why are you laughing?
I don't know. Just getting introduced is always so strange.
It is strange.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, let's bring him out with a big Detroit welcome. But the real special people are you, and I know that just sounds like some hokey thing a radio guy would say, but we really mean it because the show is set up to allow you, the public, to give public expression to your ideas.
And there are some public expressions out there. There are. A lot going on.
Yeah. I mean, we got to be honest with you. We're Mike Hogs.
So we what?
Mike Hogs.
Oh, Mike Hogs.
Mike.
Microphone hogs. Hey.
So we're going to do most of the talking. We want to get you in
here.
Yeah. Anyway, you can ring us up at 248-544-WRIF, which is?
It is 248-544-9743. Jefferson is standing by, ready to take your calls.
Open lines. And we are in the 21st century, so we can take your text at 4WRIF. That's 49743. My website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, good place to find the latest post that usually get transferred to, I know this is going to come as a big shock, that usually get transferred to our Facebook page, but we're having technical difficulties.
Well, no, it's my technical difficulties this time, but we'll tell you who the guests are. We will just verbally tell you.
I'll tell you right now, this is a guy that I've palled around with.
Oh, yeah, I think this is a great way to start the show.
Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers, who people hopefully remember. Well, you know what? Famous, so fleeting. But Bill Ayers was used by John McCain and Sarah Palin. You might not remember them. Five years ago during the 2008 election to attempt to link Barack Obama to radicalism. There was this group in the 1960s and 1970s that did this series of bombings of corporate and government sites in which no one was injured, but still, you know, not a good idea to do, on behalf of opposing wars and corporate abuses and sometimes in solidarity with the stuff that was happening. So Bill Ayers was one of them, and so was his wife, Bernadine Dorn. And they were in this group called Weatherman, which came from a Bob Dylan song. You knew that, right?
I don't think I knew that.
Really? You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows?
Nope,
From Subterranean Homesick Blues.
I don't know that either.
You don't know that song?
You're amazing. I'm sure I do if I heard it.
Oh, come on.
Peter, what do you have on your elbow?
I don't know.
Wait, your cough drop is stuck to your sweater. Look. You need me. You really need me.
I don't need you to do this on the air.
It makes for good radio.
You know, I was coming down the highway today, and I saw a sign for a news team. It said, it said, no banter.
No banter?
Yeah.
Oh, I saw that one, too.
I have no idea what radios, they'd hate me. I have no idea what television station it was from, but we're bantering.
But that's what we get paid to do.
Yeah, where do we get stuck
banter.
On? Where were, what were we before?
Bill Ayers is your
Bill
guest.
Bill Ayers, my guest.
At one o'clock.
So one of the things that the execrable Sarah Palin said was that Barack Obama was palling around with an unrepentant terrorist.
I don't think she knows words that big.
Yeah, she did. She said unrepentant.
Someone told her to say it.
So then he became this big focus of the election, and he had to have, like, police guards, he had all these death threats, and his stories about him are absolutely amazing in this new book of his called Public Enemy, and I'm interviewing him tonight at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Also, what was his name? I got to do this by memory. Ofer Sharon, just talking about glum unemployment.
Well, it's a reality.
Yeah, indeed. But we're still, maybe even Debbie in Massachusetts is listening, and she'll be able to put up some of these latest posts that I have on my website onto Facebook. And it is Facebook.com. Here, I'll actually tell you some of the stuff that maybe this will entice you to go look at my website. Oh, yeah. Last week I was telling you that I and singer-songwriter David Rovics visited the imprisoned environmental activist Marie Mason And she was in Fort Worth, Texas, in a federal prison, serving 22 years for a number of acts of environmental sabotage. I mean, absolutely incredible. Most people that do things like she does, like if you do it for profit, you get like 9 years in prison. Mm-hmm. If you do it to protect the environment, you get 22 years. So you can read his account, and he refers to me. Did you read that? Did you get a chance to read it?
I still haven't. Remember, I'm having a computer
issue. Oh, yeah, that's right. He refers to me as Detroit's most notorious anarchist.
Well.
Thanks, David. I don't know. Oh, yeah, actually, on my site, there's the guests. Yeah, right. Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident by Bill Ayers. And I'll give this one away because everyone won't, everybody probably won't be up that late. Although you can always get the podcast, right?
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
we've been pretty consistent on that one.
So
thanks,
Sarah,
Jefferson.
Sarah Palin was just hammering Bill Ayers, you know. And Bill wrote to Sarah Palin and said, look, why don't we do a TV show on Fox News called Palling Around with Bill and Sarah?
I would watch it.
You know what? Do you know how many people would watch that?
Yeah.
And she, you know, such a publicity hog, you would have thought she would have gone for it,
right.
But she never even answered him.
She can't pretend to pal around or even associate or speak to or anything with him.
Well, it would be, maybe that's interesting you say that, because she, I don't know how to say this, folks, but she's an idiot. And she can't,
truly.
She can't think on her feet. And Bill is one of the more articulate people around. Why do I call him Bill? Like he's my pal?
Because he is your pal.
He is my pal. I used to pal around with him. Not when he was blowing up buildings, that's for sure.
But you knew of him then.
No, I knew him.
You knew him,
I knew
but
him
you
back
weren't,
in the day.
You weren't,
I wasn't
engaging in such activity.
No. I was just.
You know what you were doing?
Smoking a lot. No, what?
No, you were speaking into a microphone like
That's
you are
right.
today.
That's right. Okay. Also, there is this wonderful cartoonist named R. Cobb. I wonder what his first name is. And his roots go way back into the middle 60s. And he did cartoons with the Underground. Can you see this cartoon over here?
Not really.
Okay. People have to go to my website.
Oh, wait, no, I have seen that
Okay. Peter Werby.
Explain it.
No. No, I don't want to. I want
Why?
People to go, look, this is like a tease. They got to go to their website,
okay,
Peter Werby,
okay,
W-E-R-B-E.com. And it's called An American Thanksgiving. And then a Ralph Nader essay called 21 Ways the Canadian Healthcare System is Better than Obamacare. Didn't say the American system now, right? It said 21 Ways the Canadian Healthcare System is Better than Obamacare. And then another one, which is truly ominous. It's called, Will George Zimmerman Kill Again? His History and the Law Pose Serious Risks.
Yeah, because didn't he strangle his girlfriend?
Well, his...
Allegedly?
Which time? During the dispute, his girlfriend said that Zimmerman pointed a shotgun at her for about a minute before using it to shatter a glass table. He later forced her out of the house. He just pushed me out of my house and locked me out, she said during a 9/11 call. Zimmerman, who briefly barricaded himself in the home using furniture, told an emergency dispatcher he'd never pulled a firearm and that she was crazy. He had four guns with him when he was arrested.
Seriously?
Yeah, I wonder, folks, you know, there was when this...
Now, George Zimmerman, by the way, if to refresh everyone's memory, is the man who shot and killed Trayvon Martin, who had Skittles and a Snapple on his way home from the store.
Right.
And they got, no one knows but those two, and for those who believe God and God.
Yeah.
and he got off.
And George Zimmerman killed the only witness. And some of you were defensive of George Zimmerman killing one of these. I actually lost it, but said that George Zimmerman, who killed a child. Essentially, a young teenager. And when you go back, I was looking for something, and I think it's right in this link on my website about him. And so this guy has this incredible history of violence.
Violence and extreme anger.
Yeah.
A love for guns.
Guns, yeah. What he's always,
and shooting him.
Yeah. Okay, here it is. George Zimmerman appears to be a man unhinged. And I want some of you maybe to give us a call. Not maybe. Give us a call at 248-544-WRIF And see, does any of this information make you revisit in your mind whether this man was actually the perpetrator, the cause of the death of this unarmed young man? As has been well,
those of you who didn't believe it.
Yeah, as well chronicled, the 30-year-old former neighborhood watch captain found himself back in police custody. This time he's accused of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, domestic battery. And let's see, the girlfriend's name is Samantha Scheib, told the police dispatcher Zimmerman was in the house with four weapons, including a shotgun, an AR-15-style assault rifle, and two handguns. Hey, you know, before I was married, I'd go over to my girlfriend's house. Well, I'd only have usually like two or three guns. You never could tell what's going to happen.
Yeah,
you know, right?
I only carry one.
Yeah. and it says, now the scary but inevitable question, will he kill again? Consider his history, says this article in Salon, and it's on my website. In July 2005, Zimmerman was arrested for, quote, resisting an officer with violence after he intervened in a confrontation between a friend and a police officer. Zimmerman, who was under the influence of alcohol at the time, reportedly became profane and attacked the officer. Then charges were reduced. By August of the same year, his former fiancée sought a restraining order against him on charges of domestic violence. And it kind of gives the details of that. Zimmerman's wife, Shelley, who stood by him during the trial, were called to her house following a domestic dispute. She said, I don't know what he's capable of. What do you mean you don't know what he's capable of? It says she stood by him during the trial. He's capable of shooting to death an unarmed young man.
Yes.
Then she says, I'm really, really scared. And there's an article in here by Joan Walsh that said, I'd hate to be a former Zimmerman juror today.
Oh, yeah. Just think how badly they must feel, how awful. Yeah. Hopefully, if they have any kind of heart whatsoever. And so this latest, there was an attack. And also, this girlfriend, Samantha Scheib, said that like a week and a half before this latest arrest, that he had choked her.
Yeah.
In a violent incident.
All right. Got a couple of people waiting, but I want to bring up a few other things as well. And that's the Kennedy assassination. And I don't know.
Did y'all get enough of that
on TV? Yeah.
It
is so all over the board that everything from that Kennedy was essentially conservative. I mean, okaying the Cuban invasion. You know, he won essentially by a lie, by a militaristic lie. He said that the Eisenhower-Nixon administration had created a missile gap, that is to say that we were less prepared to fight the Soviet Union, which never had any intention of fighting the United States, and when there wasn't anything like that. Probably the election was stolen in Cook County by the first Mayor Daley there in 1960. Mm. He was responsible, John Kennedy, for putting into office this Vietnamese dictator that was one of the causes of the Vietnam War.
Was that Pol?
No, Diem.
Oh, Diem, okay.
Diem, D-I-E-M, but with a Z. You know, Diem, 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 whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which never had to occur. But you know, he creates this catastrophe almost, and then looks like the genius that solved it. You know, speaking of David Rovics, who's a singer-songwriter who visited this federal prisoner with me last week, he has this song called "When Vasily Saved the World." And, you know, he's so incredible in the kind of research he does for songs. He can tell a historic story and have it all rhyme and put it together in about 20 minutes. And plus, it's really good music, which is the key. It doesn't work if it's just sort of some pedantic lecture, right?
Sure.
Like I do.
You also don't sing.
Yeah, thankfully. But that's the two things I'm not supposed to do on the air, right? Sing and try to do math.
No, there's another one.
I'm
I tell you not to do math. Your wife tells you not to sing, and you can't say her name or the
dog's
name.
Oh, yeah, dog's name, right. I don't know why. Anyway, so during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a Russian nuclear sub that had lost contact with Moscow, and they thought that nuclear confrontation was right there because...
Who's they?
Everybody.
Okay.
Both sides.
Okay.
So this sub had three admirals or three commanders on board, and if the three of them unanimously decided they should launch missiles, they were supposed to do it. And they, and at some point, they thought that this confrontation had begun, and they voted. And two of them voted to launch nuclear strikes at the United States. And Vasily, and I can't remember his last name, you know, long Russian name, Vasily voted not to. So it was this one man that might have stopped the incineration of at least the northern hemisphere and the, you know, the Soviet Union.
Boy, I wish one man could do something, perhaps in Congress, like Bernie Sanders. If only he had the power.
When Bernie,
saved the world.
Yeah. So when Vasily saved the world. So, and on the other hand, so the, a lot of people paint him as this real conservative who always bowed down to the Southern Democratic senators, the segregationists, because he needed them for, you know, support for his party. The Democrats, you know, all the racists then were in the Southern races were all in the Democratic Party. Now they all moved over to the Republican Party, right?
Yeah.
And he's portrayed as a conservative. On the other hand, there's people now that say he was going to end the Cold War. He was going to normalize relations with Cuba. He was going to dismantle the CIA because he was really pissed at him because of the Bay of Pigs and all that.
Yeah.
So it's all over the place.
Meanwhile, Reagan gets the credit for, quote-unquote, ending the Cold War.
Yeah. And so the same thing with the assassination. There, although all the official accounts always say it was Lee Harvey Oswald, only about, I forget what it is, like 24% of the American people believe that. And the majority of American people weren't even, you know, alive or, you know, or like 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, you know, years old.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there is so much stuff. Here's one. Photographs appear to show George H.W. Bush, Poppy, right?
Yep.
Then a secret CIA operative and later president to been at the Dallas site on Dealey Plaza at the Texas Book Depository building on November 22nd. The photographs show Bush standing in front of the school building with U.S. Air Force General Edward Lansdale after Kennedy was murdered. Lansdale is described in a new book as America's top political assassinations specialist for the CIA, and they did a lot of that. Attempted to assassinate Castro any number of times. Had this huge assassination program in Vietnam. And the book charges that Bush was employed at the CIA at the time. So, I don't know. What are we to believe? You know?
I don't know about that one. You know, it was funny because I was reading my email when I was home in Iowa this week.
Right.
My dad's conservative. Love him.
Love him. Hi, Wes.
And he saw over my shoulder me reading the story, and he goes, "Now what is Werby sending you now? Now he's blaming Bush." It was fabulous. I go, "No, Dad, he just sends me all kinds of things." So then I went to the story about I tried to kind of quell the situation by showing him the story about Charles Manson getting married.
And okay. We'll talk about that one a little later.
Okay.
Now, here's another book by Roger Stone, and it is called The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons. I think a lot of very sophisticated liberals, particularly. But
you mean like us?
No, you know, like establishment liberals and all that.
Okay.
Is that believing a conspiracy was involved in killing Kennedy is sort of left to the ragged fringes of American society, both left and right, in their estimation.
Boy, the fascination is just amazing to this day.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how much coverage was going on. And it was funny, I was listening to like a pop radio station, and this gal came on, she goes, "I am so sick of hearing about this." I thought, wow, you just stick to Lady Gaga, babe.
You know, someone here, a dear friend of all of ours who works here at this station and is a vice president of Greater Media, was a former program director for WRIF, and is also the general manager here as well, Tom Bender.
Yes.
Tom said, "I think absolutely that Oswald was the one that shot him." I said, "Jeez, Tom, you're no fun." But when we have at least one person that that does want to talk about the Kennedy assassination.
We did, but there was someone else who hung up. I don't know why.
This is Mr. Interesting. Let's see here.
he gets his own name.
Yeah.
Hey Ron from Shelby Township. You know you're special when you get your own name on our show.
Oh, Peter, Galeen.
Hey, Galeen, how you doing?
What do you call me?
Galeen.
Galeen?
Galeen.
Yeah, Galeen. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish a comment I was saying on the Kennedy assassination last week, and you probably remember me mentioning that just one of the reasons that Kennedy was assassinated is because he did not want to go to Vietnam. And the reason we went to Vietnam is to get uranium ore out of the country. I happen to know this sort of thing. I know somebody that was over in Vietnam, okay, and this guy was on a specific detail, and their job was solely to protect these workers from, you know, getting shot at while they were extracting uranium ore. That was the only reason we were in Vietnam, is because some U.S. Geological people were doing some surveying, you know, to find oil.
Well, I was going to say, Ron, there's a lot of stuff. Oil and the United States empire extends greatly. But there also was this anti-communist fervor there, and I don't think that should be ruled out. I mean, and one of the things, one of the key things to remember politically, not about the loss, the millions and millions of Indochinese that died as a result of the U.S. invasion of that country and the tens of thousands of Americans that died, but the next time that this happens, whether it's a war against Venezuela or wherever else the next one is going to be, is that people be as skeptical as they were about Libya. I was so happy, and I don't know, weird. I almost said proud, but it sounded a little weird. It sounded a little patronizing.
Yeah,
but people have always been fooled by American wars. Almost every single one of them is based on a lie. I mean, maybe you want to think about that. Not you, Ron, so much, but I mean, everybody else out there.
That or name one that you think that wasn't.
Yes, that's good. All right, Ron, but thanks for getting that in. Yeah, my favorite, I always say, I mean, come on, if you're listening to the show, you have at least a passing interest in politics and you know some history. And I always say to people, sometimes when I've done lectures, why did the United States enter World War One?
Yeah, that's the one.
And you hear the crickets. People go, you know. Like that. Yeah. Okay, we can get that for another day. Let's talk nukes. Here we've got
joyful.
Yeah, we've struck an historic deal with Iran and the United States. Sounds like Jolene and I. Iran has struck an historic deal with the United States just today, and also five other world powers. And what has been agreed to is a temporary freeze of Iran's nuclear program. And it's the most significant agreement between Washington and Tehran in more than three decades. Now, this is a bigger subject than really may initially appear to be. Because you would think, wow, man, I don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. I don't think any of us want, well, I was going to say, I don't think any of us want any nation to have nuclear weapons. I don't want to have any nation having them. Some people think it's okay if we have them, but we don't want them to have them.
Yeah, which now, is not how it works.
Yeah. Am I missing something here? But call in it either with an opinion or give me some more facts. 248-544-WRIF. As far as I can count them up in my head, is the countries that have nuclear weapons are the United States, Russia, Britain, France, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and on the stealth, Israel, which is armed to the teeth with nukes. And the idea is that there's a non-proliferation. In other words, things shouldn't proliferate, right? That no more countries should have, but they just kind of wind up with them. Now, the idea that the Iranians, the reason that we say we don't want the Iranians to have them is because they're crazy. And all you got to do is see these scenes on television when they're, you know, yelling and shooting guns in the air and stuff like that. Say, these are not people we want to have nuclear weapons. We want people that would have them responsibly and not use. Oh, yeah, well, the United States did use them, didn't they? There was no need to use them, of course. There was absolutely no need whatsoever to drop atomic weapons on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. But that's another question. The reason that Iran, so far away from us, despises the United States so badly is because what the United States did to Iran. forgetting, the decades of colonialism that they suffered in the 19th and 20th century, finally became free, democratically elected a government, only to have it overthrown in 1954 by, guess who? The CIA, right? Nobody disputes that anymore. Before, you know, even maybe 10 or 15 years ago, if you said the CIA overthrew democratically elected governments that were, that the CIA thought were against corporate interests, or the corporations thought were against corporate interests, and then the CIA would carry out the dirty work, you were thought of as some commie rat or something like that.
Right.
But now it's embedded in history. So who gets in? Who do they put in? Another democratically elected president? No, the Shah, S-H-A-H, somehow resurrecting some Persian dynasty from centuries before. And it ushers in this brutal police state, this horrible torture state that lasts for 25 years. Right up till 1979. And so when you see the United States vilified, our country vilified by Iran, it's not like it's for nothing. And do the rulers of Iran, who are a despicable bunch, I would say, do they use it to whip up the population and to divert them from dispossessing their own rulers in Iran from power and getting these religious nuts out from the helm of the government? By the way, the 1954 government that was overthrown by the CIA was a secular government. But so why don't we want Iran to have nuclear weapons, other than we don't want anyone else more to any other countries to have them? Who would most possibly use those weapons? Well, let's just say Iran gets it. Would Iran be number one to use it? I don't think so. Why? Who would they use it on? Well, they would attack Israel because they hate Israel, because they think Israel is just the pawn of the United States and they've dispossessed the Palestinians of their land. And all of that. But what would be the consequences of them dropping a nuclear weapon on Tel Aviv or something like that? I would suspect they would be immediately destroyed, either by Israel or by Israel and the United States.
Right.
So who would be most... I wonder what each listener is thinking. They say, hey, he's going to blame it on the United States. I know. He's going to say United States, number one person who's going to drop it on somebody. No, probably... Pakistan or India.
Yeah.
they talk about an unstable government filled with religious fanatics who are always just at a hair trigger pressure away from a war with India. That's where the problem really lies. Well, what about those nuts in North Korea? Well, they're not going to. North Korea is not going to.
They just do a whole lot of posturing.
Yeah, right. Because, they would be... They'd be gone. They talk about they're going to drown us in a lake of fire. They would be...
Yeah, I don't care how big their army is.
Yeah.
They would be done.
So one of the ways that you could... Oh, and the other thing, and I've said this before, if you have weapons of mass destruction the way North Korea does, you don't get invaded. If you don't have them the way Iraq didn't, the way the Bush criminal gang... said they did, then you do get invaded.
Yeah, and there's a little thing called oil there.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I was having a conversation with my dad. He said, why are we in Afghanistan, Julian? You know, it's kind of weird when your father asks you. And I said, that's a really good question, Dad. Why do you think we're in there? He goes, I don't even get it. And I said, Nobody gets it.
Well, you know why we're there? We're there.
Because
that's why we're
there. And now they're talking about extending into it, and we can...
10 years.
Yeah. I was trying to explain to him, there's a whole thing, it's called big business. It's called the military-industrial complex. It's called a lot of people from the United States are making a whole lot of money from being there, the military contractors, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, who's paying this, too?
Well, you and me, all of you listening in the listening audience.
I was talking to some of these right-wing guys I play handball with, and I said, we ought to have Medicare for everybody, everybody in, nobody out. And they said, where are you going to get the money from it? I said, do you realize that Obama is just planning to sign a pact that would have our troops in Afghanistan for another 10 years? Right there. There it all is. National health, everybody, paid for.
Yeah.
All that.
Get the hell out of there. Well, anyway, back to Iran. This is a 6-month
deal.
It's only a six-month deal.
Yeah.
And in exchange for limited and gradual sanctions relief, including access to $4.2 billion from oil sales. You would think they'd want that, huh?
Yeah. And Israel says it was an historic mistake. And one thing they're concerned about, they will not have the monopoly on force in the Middle East. And they might have to do things like actually negotiate about their...
About their own nuclears.
Yeah, and their illegal annexation of...
Palestinians.
Yeah, Palestinian territory.
Right.
Okay, let's take a break. Hey, Eric from Roseville, you hang on. You're next. And
we have some open lines.
We have some open lines.
And you know what? We're not going to rely on Mr. Announcer to give the number because it's not in there. Remember, it's 248-544-9743.
Right.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. Peter and Jalee will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend. Brought to you by Tim Hortons. Try Tim Hortons Minty Candy Cane Hot Chocolate paired with a marvelous candy cane donut or the amazing holiday gingerbread flavor in the new delicious gingerbread latte and the delectable gingerbread glazed donut. The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Jalee.
And we're taking your calls at 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
And I forgot to tell you, you can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I finally found, remember last week I didn't have the password.
Did you figure that all out, Peter?
I got it. Yeah, I got it. One of the things we're asking, any of those of you who called in here and vigorously defended the right of an armed man to shoot to death an unarmed teenager, we're talking about George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, now all this stuff comes out again. He goes over to his girlfriend's house with an AR-15, a shotgun,
oh,
and two handguns, threatens her, and one of the things...
shot up her coffee table.
No, he smashed it.
Oh, he smashed it.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
But he choked her the week before.
Yeah. You think this guy has anger problems? Think maybe he, after all, you're having a second thought. Joan Walsh writes on Salon.com, I'd hate to be a former Zimmerman juror today. Well, we were the jury of public opinion, and some of you said, yeah, well, you know, he got attacked, and he had to stand his ground.
Did you see his face?
Yeah, right. Did you see his face?
Yeah. You know, well, always looking back, we're usually right. I mean, I'm not tooting our own horn, but, you know,
that's true.
We're right about a lot of things.
So we're talking, too, about the nuclear deal, which blocks Iran's path to a bomb. But I'm saying nobody should have the bomb. And one of the things that Barack Obama should do with this Nobel Peace Prize, how the hell did he ever get that? I don't get it.
Yeah, but Mr. Drone himself.
Yeah, he should be leading the way for world nuclear disarmament. And you know what? I'll bet if we said to Israel, hey, we're going to stop giving you $2 or $3 billion a year of our tax money. It's like $30 billion over a decade, unless you get rid of your nukes because everybody else is getting rid of them.
You know what's wild? When I was back in Iowa, my friend lives kind of by the airport in a flight path, and she said that it's, you know, I asked her if the noise bothered her, and she said, well, the F-16s used to fly over, but now they don't have them anymore. You know why?
Why?
Drones.
Oh?
They've been replaced with drones, and they're quiet and little
and
dangerous.
All right, folks starting to call in, but
we've
been talking about the JFK assassination as well. So if you're ringing, be patient.
Yeah.
But we said we're going to get to Eric in Roseville, wants to talk about Oswald and the assassination. Hey, Eric, you're on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for taking my call, and there'll be no ideology today. The thing about the killing, though, the one thing that says it all to me is in Vietnam, we had a Marine sniper named Carlos Hathcock. He had 230 confirmed kills. He was on a local talk show host, and the guy asked him point blank, could Oswald have made that shot with that gun? And he said, no, because I tried it. And then one final comment, and I'll hang up if I could, about Kennedy and nukes.
Sure.
After the Cuban Missile Crisis, there's a story that he was in some garden over in Europe with Khrushchev, with their entourages, and Kennedy stopped, looked him in the eye, and said, "You realize if we go to war, after you lost 10 million in World War II, you're going to lose that many in the first hour." And apparently, Khrushchev responded, "Lucky for us, we got a lot of people." Good night.
Wow.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric. And, a couple of people wrote in to me and said that that Oswald could have done the shot of, you know, this Mannlicher Carcano, the World War One bolt action rifle was actually a good one. And I said last week, I was just last Sunday, I was in Dallas. You know, on Saturday, the day before that, Saturday, I was at Dealey Plaza, and it's amazing how small a area it is. And
it is.
And anybody on the sixth floor of the Texas Book Depository building almost could have spit on him. So
yeah.
Let's say you could get off one shot. Then having the bolt action, I don't know if everybody knows what that means, but you got to take this bolt kind of, you got to take the rifle away from your sight line. Okay, I can't show with my hands, right? So, well, you've all seen that. You got to, you know, put the bolt back, which ejects the spent shell. Then you got to chamber the next round. Then you got to find your target with a scope, which is really difficult, and then get off another good shot. Doesn't seem possible to me. And some Olympiads, as Eric was saying, other people have tried, but these Olympiads tried it and could not reproduce the shot.
How about that?
So it seems kind of impossible. Here is just says question for Peter. Hi, you're okay. On the air. Who's this? Oh, I gotta press a little button. My apologies here. I think that put you on the air. Are you there?
You did. You still haven't pressed it.
Huh? I'm pressing it. Look, doesn't it, when it has the minus sign, does that mean he's on?
No, that's he's talking to our producer.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so I shouldn't be...
So go do a different one.
Okay. Sorry, I got it. All right. Here is James. James Downriver. How you doing, James? What's up?
Yes. Hi. I was complaining on that. You know, like, somebody from Downriver took a shot, if they took a shot, you know, I'm talking about a Marine, a true sniper, if they would not let their barrel hang out that side of a building. A sniper would hold back inside that building and not let his barrel be shown.
Well, he did have some. Right. I don't know if Oswald was a sniper, but I remember that he was. That he had some training as a Marine. But you're right; it probably wouldn't have had the barrel sticking out. And
listen,
here, there actually, James, is two theories. One is that, in fact, that Oswald let loose with the first shot, but didn't take the second, or some people even say the third. And other people say he didn't do any shots whatsoever. Some people put him on, like, the second floor and all that. I mean, can you imagine, with all the incredible historic work that people do to reconstruct events that happened, you know, decades ago, sometimes 100 years ago, there's so many different stories. Isn't that crazy?
I know. Sir, all I'm saying is...
No, I hear you.
Somebody stuck a barrel out to be seen.
Oh.
That is what the question is.
Oh.
That barrel was showing. That barrel was showing.
That's interesting.
It was CIA. See, now listen, when if it's a true sniper from, you know, from Vietnam or whatever,
yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, you got a fucking true.
Oh. Get it, Peter. Hit it now. Yeah. Hit it. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that disqualifies you. Sorry, James. I know it slips out. It's becoming more and more common
just
language.
Just carry on.
Yeah. But
did you see that they moved Sirhan to a new facility?
No.
They moved him from one area of California to another one. I guess it's that. For those who don't know, is the one who assassinated
Robert
Kennedy. Yeah.
Wow. All right. More on that if you like. 313-29...
248-544-9743. God,
yeah.
I wish they wouldn't have changed those phone
numbers.
Yeah,
this was like for 30 years. Then. Yeah. Here's Brian in Detroit. Brian, hi. You're on the air.
Hello there, Peter. How you doing?
We're well. Thank you.
I was on a few weeks ago. This is Brian. I'm in California right now. I'm from Detroit. I have the BB and the Detroit 420 show. And I obviously have topics about the 420 discussion. Good friend of John Sinclair has been around for 40 years, activist and everything. But we talked about the conditions of the VA hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And at the time, you were... up quite a bit for that, and in the recent days we've had quite a bit of bad publicity with the VA. I don't know if you're up to the information, but the mortality rate of the VA hospital seems to be quite higher than any normal hospital, and you know, for simple procedures.
Is that right? So, that's terrible.
And Detroit, which seems to be one of the worst that I've ever seen, and I'm going to this one out in L.A. right now that I go out to, and conditions are 100% different. But like I say, it's not true everywhere in the country, of course. But yeah, that's one subject I wanted to touch on. And of course,
let me just back up. I'm not disputing anything you say because all of this is experiential. And when a doctor cures us, we say they're a genius. When we call them and we can't get the appointment we want, and then he cancels it and all that, they do something wrong, we say they're butchers. I've got two friends that go to the Detroit VA hospital, and they speak highly of it. So I'm not disputing you, but I'm just saying that there's...
It could be case by case.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, Brian, is this just your experience, or is this larger than that? I mean, your experience counts for sure.
Oh, yes, sir. Well, this is noted. It was an article, I can't recall exactly, the day before yesterday it came out on CNN, and they were saying that people are sometimes diagnosed so late when they get cancer, by the time they get chemotherapy, it's too late. And that's 80% of the cases of cancer cases in the VA. And that is a fact to my knowledge. Now, Steve Nager of High Times Magazine also has an article of Smashwords through that, too. And he's also on my website. But, yes.
What's your website? Hey, Brian, what's your website?
My website is Brian Robert Turnbull on Facebook, but we are down as the Detroit 420 Show.
Okay.
www.com.
You guys had that show on. It was an AM radio, right?
It was at 1310 AM for really.
Remember that?
But the whole station. It was like a liberal talk station, and then they pulled a plug.
Yes.
No, there's nothing anymore.
Nothing.
No,
there?
It's empty station. Empty.
We
signal.
Are the lone liberals in Detroit.
Yes, you're right. You're right. So, sometimes, you know, the voices of the small people get squelched. But I definitely say we should vote for the third party. You guys do a great job of touching on all topics. If I had time, I'd like to touch them all, but we know we can't.
All right.
But you guys do a great job. I really enjoyed the show, and I'd like to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, thank you very much, Brian,
right.
And we wish you the best.
Yeah, right. I'm for... third party, fourth party? Oh, he's talking about political party.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd probably be good. You know, I'm thinking...
You're down with a good party once in a while, too. You know,
this was extraordinary. This was extraordinary. You know, there's this new phenomena called apple picking. You know of this?
No.
That's when people, and this happened to my niece in New York, standing on a corner talking, young guy just walks by, grabs her phone and takes off.
Oh, apple phone picking. Did they really?
Yeah. Yeah.
No kidding.
And sometimes then they have a lot of...
You know, was she on the phone or she was just holding
it? She was talking, yeah.
And they just took it?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah. So lawmakers in San Francisco and New York, where she lives, my niece lives, are pushing telephone makers to adopt a so-called kill switch that would allow users to deactivate their phone remotely, discouraging criminals from stealing phones. Great idea?
Well, I don't know.
You think I'm setting you up?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well, it is a great idea. So, in other words, if someone grabbed your phone, that you could deactivate it. I don't
how?
Know.
How?
I don't know whether
is it
you...
like a button, like I've fallen and I can't get up or something.
I don't know. Maybe you'd have to go to another computer, or you know.
You could do that now. All you have to do is you know, call the phone store or go to the phone store and say to deactivate my account.
Yeah. Well. But how about this? I don't know. It says they wanted this built into the technology of the phone. But I'm not sure. Let me see. But guess what? All the cell phone carriers don't like it at all.
And why?
You know what? I saw this. The headline is...
They want to rat people to rack up a bill or something?
Carriers reject a kill switch for preventing cell phone theft. It's in the business of technology section, the bits section of the New York Times. And usually I can... think in advance. I had no idea, and I'm willing to bet, unless you know this, that you have no idea. Well, let me do this. Why don't we put this out there and say, Anybody want to guess? Here we got this thing. It would be a kill switch for preventing cell phone theft because the people...
But it's not going to prevent it. They're still going to have the phone.
Well, I don't know what then that it does. But why would the carriers object to having a kill switch on a cell phone?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
You know,
perplexing you, right? Because it did
it
make
is.
Yeah.
Well, a few weeks ago, and it wasn't an Apple, but my boyfriend had his phone stolen, and I could not get a hold of him, and I started getting, like, pissed, you know what I mean? It's like, that bastard, he better call me, you know? I mean, really, I'm a sweetheart, but, man, I can get mad. And I'm a feisty little thing. So he finally got a hold of me from a payphone. Do you know those still exist?
There's payphones?
Yes.
Yeah, they are once in a while.
I was desperately texting him, like, where are you? I was worried about him because he has diabetes. I worry about him all the time. And the guy texted back who stole his phone and said, I found this phone and I'm keeping it. At least he was honest.
Hey, a friend of mine, a tradesman, was at a job site.
Yeah.
And he left his keys in the ignition, his cell phone on the seat, and all of a sudden he sees his van taken off.
No.
Thousands of dollars worth of tools on. So he grabs one of his workers' cell phones and calls his cell phone. The guy answers it. He goes, yeah.
Yeah, I got your stuff.
That's what he said.
And what happened? You should have called 911 first.
He should have, but he wanted to sell it back.
To him?
To him, yeah.
People are so desperate these days.
Now, this I don't get. This is one of these questions. Jefferson's in the other room answering our calls at 248-544-WRIF. And he says, Danny from Royal Oak called in with a question for Peter. How does Bush rate on a terrorist level? Is he worse than Hitler or Stalin? You know.
Oh, gosh.
This is, for one thing, they're not terrorists. These are people that created wars. And, of course, the internal repression of Germany and Russia, Soviet Union, that Stalin created is nothing like Bush did. But,
I think maybe
think it's sarcastic.
Or it could be. Who was worse at, war crimes?
Hitler.
Hitler. Let's think about that for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gosh, the phones are ringing off the hook.
Put them on hold.
I will.
Yeah, okay. Because Jefferson is, you always got to be patient, too. Because sometimes you start chatting Jefferson up. Oh, people are calling in, I suspect, with why would the carriers reject a kill switch for preventing cell phone theft? Let me see if I can read a little more into this. The cell phone market is hugely lucrative with sales of handsets bringing in almost $70 billion in the United States last year. But thefts of smartphones continue to rise. Thefts of Apple devices have become so widespread that the police have nicknamed it Apple picking. So these attorney generals have formed the Secure Our Smartphones Coalition to press businesses to solve the problem technologically. All right. So let me see. We're going to let and you can call in at and see if you can guess why they would be at it. Well, let's beat up on one of our well-deserving targets.
Might as well just put it out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which one?
Walmart.
Oh, okay.
Now, I think most of you remember. I hope you do, because it has to do with all the clothing that I wear and that you wear.
From China, you mean?
And well, in this case, Bangladesh.
Oh, yes, this. Ooh.
Because there was this fire at this factory called Tazreen in Bangladesh, and
it wasn't recent. It was
a year ago.
Yeah,
yeah. And then there was also the Rana Plaza building that collapsed last spring, and. What's happening, though, is that many of the retailers that sold garments produced at these two places are refusing to join an effort to compensate the families of more than 1,200 workers who died in those disasters. Also, 1,800 were injured. So
some of them still in the hospital.
Yeah,
from 1 year ago.
All right, but this is disjointed, I know, but it suits my ADD self. But a couple of people want to guess.
Jesse in Petersburg and Chris in Royal Oak. We're coming right to you.
Well, let's go to Petersburg first because that is Ontario. And Jesse, thanks for joining us, and thanks for making our show international. Now, here's the deal that these lawmakers want to make so you can adopt a so-called kill switch that would allow users to deactivate their phones remotely, but the cell phone carriers don't like it at all. Why would they?
Correct.
Why do you think?
Well, you know, there's a couple different reasons. The first one, namely, they make a lot of money off of third-party companies' insurance policies.
There you go.
A lot of these insurance policies, a lot like Asurion, who happens to be one of the largest, you know, stakeholders in this, who, you know, actually owns most of the contracts for the largest cell phone carriers in the nation. You know, they charge deductibles with this, but they also offer lost and stolen policies. The other thing is, if you don't have that, a lot of times what we're taught to do in the cell phone industry is to, you know, call back in, and then basically from there we'll say, well, you know, since you don't have this insurance or something like that, you're going to have to purchase the phone outright. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to, you know, open up a new line of service. So by doing that, you're also increasing your time or length of, you know, service with that company as well. So there's a couple different ways that they can, you know, go about doing it, but all of them are extremely profitable. And what you'll find is a lot of the people who with a little bit more expendable income, maybe who didn't subscribe to these insurance policies, or maybe even who did, one, they're more likely to stay with the carrier that they're with if they have a really good experience with an insurance kind of claim deal with that. And then the other thing is they can also have a whole lot more money to be made off the back end of that should they choose to, you know, open up a new line of service and do something like that.
Well, you nailed it. You certainly know a lot more even in this article. I'll just read you the one line, and it essentially says what you said. The carriers are concerned that the software that would be the kill switch would eat into the profit that they make from the insurance program many consumers buy to cover lost or stolen phones. Well, answer me this, if you can. How does these kill switch work? I mean, say someone grabbed my phone. How do I activate the kill switch? Do you know that?
Well, there's a couple different things. First off, with most Apple products, since we were talking about Apple picking, for instance, they have something called Find My iPhone that's actually integrated into iOS 7, which is the current operating system that's on there. In fact, I just used that today for my girlfriend to try and track down her phone. So you can actually lock your phone remotely, and from there, basically nobody can sign into there until you know, they've entered in the correct password. You can call the carrier if you want to, and then from there, the carrier can actually block data, text messaging, calling from there, doing a lot of that. But kill switches, I mean, it's
I'm sorry,
it's
I thought you said
technology.
Something different. That's why I'm laughing. Yeah. I thought you said find my, you know.
A-hole.
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, you said iPhone.
Yeah, no.
I'm sorry. You're Canadian. No, you're, right. You're way too polite for that. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. You know, so either way, I mean, these technologies already exist, and in many instances, insurance companies or a lot of manufacturers are actually starting to advertise that their products come out with that. You know, a lot of third-party retailers like Best Buy, for instance, also offer, you know, active ways to lock down your phone and do that as well, so...
Well, Jesse, actually, I'm looking at the clock on the wall. I got to fit something in before midnight. So thank you for that information. Yeah, I said you nailed it. And everybody else that was on, I was curious. I wanted to get you on because it's a long distance call, but I was curious whether other people knew it or whether they just would have come up with some cockamamie, answers, which could have been fun. So thank you very much.
I just have the privilege of working in the business. But thank you so much for having me in there.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah. All right. We'll be right back.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Join 101 WRIF and Holy Cross Children's Services as we rock for a reason. We're raising money for vulnerable and forgotten kids here in Michigan, and we need your help. Visit Albert's on the Alley or CJ Mahoney's, and for a minimum $1 donation, you'll receive a WRIF Holy Cross guitar pick. It's your chance to join the RIF as we support these kids in crisis. All proceeds from the RIF guitar picks will benefit Holy Cross Children's Services and kids that are vulnerable and forgotten. We want to make sure no child will be forgotten. Help us make a difference. Find locations where you can help online at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Wait, what?
Everything that rocks.
I want to hit the rim. Yeah. I want to hit the rim. Show the resistance. It's time to testify. I want to know. Are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Rift award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much. Our number, if you'd like to join in this conversation, 248-544-WRIF.
It is 248-544-9743.
Your email is at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Ronald writes in, the Google Nexus phone does have a remote management thing that will let you locate the phone on a map and optionally erase and lock it. There are also apps for Android phones on the other carriers that do the same thing. So there are these apps. You know, how do you do this? I guess there's an app for finding your car, like in a big, huge,
yeah,
like if you're out of the palace or something like that.
I lose my car all the time. I need that.
Yeah, I think it's probably free.
Yes. I have one app.
I have none.
I know.
Well, I guess I do. I guess I have more.
I have one.
Part of the weather.
It's called Shazam.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
but why do you need that?
Because I'll be in my car, and
yeah,
I don't have RDS in my car.
Okay.
And so
nobody knows Shazam, RDS.
Okay. Well, RDS is when you can see what artists or
yeah,
music are playing.
Right.
And we provide that service here at our radio stations at Greater Media if you have the capability in your car. I don't. But Shazam is where if you're in the car and you hear a song, you hit this, and it will recognize the song and tell you what it is. It's amazing,
sure,
to me. It's amazing.
How
to
did
me.
They have that much in there? Yeah. You know, actually, we were in a restaurant, a bunch of us guys after playing handball, and there was this jazz on, and it sounded like stuff from the 50s, and I said, you know, that's Miles Davis and the Jazz Giants. And somebody said, no, it's blah, 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 you know. And they just held up Shazam.
It's Shazam!
And this is pretty obscure jazz.
Yeah.
And it had it in there.
Isn't it amazing?
It's amazing.
I love Shazam. That's all I have.
Did I say this on the air, though? I was, I said at the beginning of the show, and you can go to my website, by the way. I couldn't even get that one out. By the way.
By the by.
My website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And there's an account of myself and singer-songwriter David Rovics visiting the imprisoned environmental activist Marie Mason. And so we're going all over town, and he's got this GPS, and I said...
He uses that GPS like crazy.
Well, he travels all around the world.
Oh, yeah. He's got that thing mastered.
He does.
I've been with him when he's used the GPS.
And so I'm thinking, so I said, you know, David, they could just drone strike us.
Because they could find you?
Oh, and like in a, you know, a half a second or something
he's
like that.
He's not afraid of anything.
Okay. Let's go back to our phones, and then I'll get back to Bangladesh. Here's Regina in East Point. Regina, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
What?
Anyway,
hi, Regina.
Hi, sweetheart. My topic is the Kennedy assassination.
What do you think?
Oh, I was 19 years old, and I went to a movie theater in East Point, and I saw this movie. It was called Presidential Action. And
No, Executive Action.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, I've been searching through the archives of my mind. You saw it too, didn't you?
Oh, you can still get it, like on Netflix.
Have you seen it, Peter?
Yeah. Was that with Clint Eastwood? No.
No, no.
Okay.
I don't think there were any big stars in it. And I walked out of that movie so impressed. I was 19 at the time. And it just disappeared out of all the movie theaters. How did you see it?
I don't know. I think it's just a regular old film. We're going to get...
You can find it on Netflix.
We're
going to
get the Night Call research.
Well, you know what? I don't have... I have a computer, but I don't know how to use it.
Oh,
well, stay as sweet as you are. It'll just eat up your time and eat up your money. But I want to do this, Regina. I'm going to get the Night Call researchers on this. Executive action, please. When was it done and who's in it and all that? We'll have that for you just in a few minutes.
Well, you know, that's irrelevant. I just couldn't believe there were like 42 witnesses that just disappeared off the face of the earth. And then the movie was not shown in any theaters. And that makes me believe in a conspiracy theory.
Okay. Who do you think did it?
Oh, good Lord knows.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that, Regina, because about 2 or 3 years ago, you remember that, Jalene? I just opened the mic and I said, just call up and say who you think did it, and then I'm going to go right on to the next caller. And most of the people said the CIA, some people said the right wingers, a couple people maybe said, I don't know, whoever, Soviets, Cuba, whatever. And then finally, after we and there was like, one person said, I don't care. And then and then someone said,
is it bad to not care?
I don't know. It happened 50 years ago, for one thing. I mean, we shouldn't. Politics by assassination is pretty awful, and that's what occurred in the.
But what difference does it make now?
Well, you think about the people that were killed. They were all people on the left.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King. The Kennedy brothers, Malcolm X.
Yeah.
You know?
And I care about, you know. I care about the fact that people died.
Oh, yeah, I got it. What was his name? George Wallace, though. He was a right-winger, segregationist. Although, you know, he changed at the end of his life.
He did.
Yeah, getting shot kind of messes your mind up.
Yeah, and sometimes just getting older, you kind of soften a little bit. My old grandpa was a hardcore one, and then he got old, and he softened up.
All right, Regina, thank you very much. We're going to get on it and look for executive action, try to find out.
I haven't talked to you for a while, Regina. Thanks for calling.
She's gone. Where I was looking for, I don't know. I have to get it. What were we talking about? Oh, yeah.
Kennedy.
Kennedy assassination. So, give the phone number.
Peter, what are you? Maybe I can look for it for you. How about that?
Here. Yeah, there it is. Joseph P. Franklin, a white supremacist who killed at least 8 people in a shooting spree from 1977 to 1980 and confessed to being the sniper who wounded the Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint.
Oh, yeah.
And the lawyer and civil rights activist Vernon Jordan. Wow, that's your last name, isn't it?
Sure is.
Yeah. Was executed on Wednesday in Missouri. His lethal injection, blah, blah, blah. He was convicted of 9 murders, but considered a suspect in a dozen more. This guy, this racist, insane character, killed like over 20 people.
Gosh.
He murdered, and he was a racist, anti-Semite. He killed, he was sentenced to death for the murder of Gerald Gordon, one of the 3 people hit by long-range rifle fire in 1977 outside a suburban St. Louis synagogue. He confessed to the crime 17 years later from a prison cell. Get this, Mr. Gordon, a guest at the bar mitzvah, was not Jewish. So, I mean, not that matters.
So he figured everyone who was there was Jewish, probably.
Yeah. So it occurs to me, you know, I think it's very human to think, die, son of a bitch.
Yeah,
but
we're both anti-death penalty.
And I would have
just
opposed.
Sit in there and rot, son of a bitch.
Yeah, yeah. that's what I would have thought. Yeah. So even in egregious crimes with someone who has no redeeming value, that he's lost all of his humanity, he has so moved so far away from, why do I bring this in, his Buddha nature, his perfect human being, because, you know, without all of the influences around us, I believe that we're all loving and caring and supportive and all the things that make us human.
Well, we're born that way. And then people, you know, oftentimes parents or whatever type of influence you have, that's what makes us imperfect.
Yeah. So it seems that, here would be an incredible argument for the death penalty. But I guess, you know, I'm an absolutist even, like, for instance, after World War II, all these Nazi war criminals were executed. And talk about people that they were responsible for tens of millions of deaths. I mean, I don't know if you add up, because the Japanese probably wouldn't have done anything if it wasn't for the Germans, I don't know. They were at war during the 30s. But anyway, let's just say the Nazis. I mean, they talk about people that whose crimes were in the tens of millions.
Yeah.
I mean, 6 million Jews, 2 and 3 million Slavs and gays and labor people and communists. And then in the war, 20 million Russians died. And
I went to that the monument in Amsterdam for gay people who were killed in the Holocaust. I did. It's called the Homo Monument or something like that.
I like it.
I do too. I do too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it that they were killed.
No.
And if you think about it, they were trying to create a master race, a super race, and they were such a pack of twistoids.
They wanted a race of people who look like me. Do you understand that? Blonde hair, blue eyes. That's what they wanted.
Yeah. Wow. I'm sitting next to somebody from the master race?
I am the master race.
Except,
all right.
Except they, you know, well, I don't know.
They're a bunch of sick, you know, what.
And if you ever look, none of them looked like that, though. Hitler?
I know.
Yeah,
but
Goering?
You know, all the experiments, that's what they were aiming for.
Yeah.
People who look like me. I know. Right. I'm almost ashamed.
Well, I thought we'd switch or we'd gotten the answer for the kill switch, but here is Jay in Brighton. Jay wants to talk about the kill switch
up,
a little.
Peter.
Oh, sorry. Maybe he was talking, talking about something else.
Now, one thing we have to always remind people, even if we're talking about another subject, it doesn't matter. We will go back to that subject. If we've moved on, it doesn't mean you can't comment on it. And maybe we don't say that enough anymore.
And you got to remember, we're in this because we have institutionalized ADD.
Unmedicated.
Unmedicated ADD. So we go boom, 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 boom. And when we do DJ shifts, we play, you know, we do something different every 3 minutes or every 5 minutes.
Right? Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Depending on the song, unless it's Stairway to Heaven.
I hate those long songs. Actually, I like them.
I love Stairway to Heaven or Freebird. Give me a little Freebird any day.
Was I just playing? Johnny Winter Group doing a live version of Tobacco Road. You ready for this? 17 minutes.
Dang.
Yeah.
That's not allowed on the radio anymore.
No. Dire Straits has a song called Telegraph Road.
Yeah.
And you would think that would be I'll bet you there's hundreds of telegraph roads. In other words, the road that went along the first telegraph, say, in the 1840s. But it is actually about the Detroit Telegraph Road.
Is it really?
And it's sort of the history of the Europeans coming to the area. Yeah, Mark Knopfler was in Detroit, the lead guitar and singer-songwriter with Dire Straits, and put this together. It's an incredible song.
We live in such aside from all the problems we have such a cool city with such great history.
Yeah. And so what were we talking about? Yeah, Bangladesh.
Speaking of ADD.
Yeah. So here's the deal. A year after the Tazreen factory fire in Bangladesh and also the collapse of the Rana Plaza building, there is more than 3,000 injuries. And so the International Labor Organization is working with Bangladeshi officials, labor groups, and several international retailers to create this compensation funds to assist not just the families of the dead, but also all of these workers who are injured, and some of them are still hospitalized.
Yeah.
So in order to get us cool, cheap clothing, and I don't even know if I, wait a minute, let me just take off cheap. Because if you think that these people in Bangladesh are making the minimum wage and what they get.
They make like $30 a month.
Oh,
yeah.
God, I hate when people exaggerate. They're making 38.
Oh, 38, that's right.
Yeah. 38, this is not an hour. This is not.
This is a month.
Yeah, this is a month. So guess who, in these retailers who I've heard of, Primark, or Primark, an Anglo-Irish company, C&A, a Dutch-German company, they're right there with it. But, hey, guess what? Walmart says it ain't paying. Sears says it ain't paying. You ever hear of Children's Place? I've never heard of them.
No.
No, but they say they're not paying. They were, nor are any of the other American companies that were selling goods produced at Tazreen or Rana Plaza, and none of them have agreed to contribute to the effort.
Like, seriously, would we ever expect Walmart to do that? Hail no.
Maybe they don't have the money.
Oh, whatever. Yeah, right.
Even as labor advocates single out Primark, I've never heard this pronounced.
So
it's either Primark or Primark. For praise, they single out Walmart for criticism, partly because production documents recovered after the Tazreen fire indicate that the 2 months before the fire erupted, 55% of the factory's production was being done by Walmart contractors. And let's see. Samantha Marr says, Walmart is the one company that is showing an astonishing lack of responsibility. Well, that's something really different for them, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Considering that so much of their product was being made at the Tazreen factory. And then it goes on and on.
And so, there were in this article also, it says there are precedents for such a fund. After 29 workers died in the Hamim garment factory in Bangladesh in December 2010, the Gap, JCPenney, and Target joined other retailers in paying into a modest compensation fund. So,
here's an old article.
Get to good old Target.
That I was holding on to. It says, six of the Waltons have more wealth than the bottom 30% of Americans.
Yeah.
Six people have more money than the bottom third, almost, of this country. Now, he said, well, they earned it. You know, and the bosses love you. The bosses love you. Anybody who thinks that. The wealthy people love you. They just think you're just wonderful and you have good ideas. Because you support the fact that they, well, one of the reasons they have billions is because they don't pay into compensation funds.
They don't.
And they don't pay health care.
Yeah, they say, well, you know, I mean, we say this all the time, but in the break rooms it says how to get
Medicaid.
You know, Medicaid.
So
and,
we pay for it. We pay.
And
we subsidize.
People make fun of the people who shop there because of the way they look. Have you seen any of that on Facebook?
No.
People are so mean.
Yeah.
People are just so mean and nasty about it. You know, if someone is overweight or doesn't or is poor or anything, I have no tolerance for that.
I don't. Yeah,
I mean, I wouldn't shop at Walmart anyway. But you know, just what's wrong with people?
Well, you know,
spirited.
What I don't know the difference. The difference between Walmart and I have to say I don't do much of the shopping in our family.
You don't do any of it.
Including clothing, shoes. I go to get my own shoes. That's it.
Big boy.
Hey, I look okay. I don't know.
Yeah, except but now that you got the cough drop that was stuck to your sweater up.
But so like Costco or Myers. Myers is, have you been in that new store on 8 Mile Road and
no.
Woodward? Oh, I mean, are they all that big?
Yes. They are all that big.
They have like 30 checkout counters or something?
Oh, yeah, they're all that big. Well, but Costco, they're pretty good to their employees.
Both Costco and Meijer have union employees.
Yes.
They pay good wages. They pay good health care.
There's also with Costco, I believe they give partner benefits for gay couples.
Really?
I believe so.
The Costco chief exec, I think we've mentioned this before, makes in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. The
rather than the millions
CEO,
and millions.
Yeah, who makes millions. But the Waltons, now this article, let me see, this says...
and Michelle, by the way, we're going to be right with you, so just hang on the line.
Yeah. This is, the Waltons are now, and this is an old article, the Waltons now, the six Waltons who never did a day's work in their life, so it's not like they earned it. Are worth about $93 billion. According to this old article, I think now it's up to about $110 billion.
Yowza.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, you know what we want to do? Take away their money.
You look so sinister when you say it.
Leave these selfish son of a bitches with about, oh, I don't know, how much? Just take it all. No, let's leave them with $100 million.
They can have that.
Yeah, sure. Give them each $100
million. Sure.
What do you think? Take it all from leave them only with $100 million.
They need to throw some money Detroit's way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, we could take $30 billion of it and just pay off this long-term debt.
Yeah.
Problem solved.
Yeah.
And guess what? So, okay. No, forget about leaving with $100 million. We'll leave them each, let me see, what would that be? Each with $10 million. $10 billion. $10 billion.
$10 billion.
$10 billion.
That is awfully generous of you, Peter Worby.
So they pay off Detroit's debt. Well, wait a minute. You know what? No, it's only, wait a minute, it's only $18 billion, the long-term debt.
Here you go,
doing math. Yeah, we can pay off Chicago.
Knock it off.
All right, let's go to Michelle. Hi, Michelle, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Julene.
Hi,
Michelle.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
We're awesome.
Good.
We're echoing.
I think your radio's on.
No.
It's just super psychic craziness. Go ahead.
What was that? Well,
psychedelic man.
Do you hear an echo now?
No.
Yes. But it doesn't matter. Go ahead.
Just when we talk. So why don't we let you talk?
That's really weird because when I've called to request songs, I always hear an echo, but I'm not hearing it now.
Okay.
It has to do with this new phone number, you guys.
Oh, maybe.
This new phone number, I'll get over it eventually, but yeah. It's been a hard
time. Me too, Julian. I know. Okay, anyway, I was just calling about the Kennedy assassination.
Sure.
Yes, and just to reflect on, because it was exactly 50 years ago, you know, just in how we've had this incredible advancement, you know, in our technology. And, you know, at that time, you know, I mean, everybody has so many different technology things they can be doing. But at that time, you know, everybody was glued to their TV sets. And, you know, they had 24-hour coverage of that, you know, the Kennedy assassination.
Sure.
And, you know, I just think it's really interesting to think about, you know, that everybody was, because I was listening to another program where, you know, they were saying the country was even getting worn out because all the news channels were just covering it, you know, 24 hours a day. And people were just, you know, I mean, that's what everybody was, you know, they even said, like, you know, almost 90% of the American public was just watching that.
Really?
I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure about the percentage.
No, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
I took the echo out just by...
Because that was a huge...
A lot of people.
Thing.
But let me ask you this, Michelle. In all the coverage, did they routinely say that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin?
I don't know, but what I heard was that then one of the major news networks, you know, out of ABC and NBC, it was getting kind of boring. So then they told them to go over to the live thing that was showing Lee Harvey Oswald, I guess. And then that's when he got shot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they were really happy that whoever made that decision, like, this is getting kind of boring, just go over to showing, you know, him at the time. I don't know. I don't even know.
Yeah, that
so
same,
they were able to
that
capture
incredible
that.
Footage over and over and over again. Well, a little earlier, you may remember, Michelle, Regina called in and was talking about this film, Executive Action. And DS, who now is an official member of the Night Call research team, he says Executive Action is a 1973 film about the assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy, written by Dalton Trumbo, who is an interesting guy in himself, a director and a screenwriter. Donald Freed, now who the hell is that? I remember that. And Mark Lane, Mark Lane was one of the first researchers to suggest that there was a conspiracy. And he wrote a book called Rush to Judgment, which challenged the conclusion of the Warren Commission.
So you mean like CIA?
What do you mean?
The CIA conspiracy?
Yeah. Right. Let's see. There's too much here. But it's in, if you go to Wikipedia, the internet, you can get that. So Shem trying to think. So this was a 1973 film. So that was done 10 years after the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. And it's with, guess who? Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, and Will Gere. So this was...
I know Burt Lancaster.
Yeah. Well, these other guys were, you know,
then.
50s and 60s guys. Mm-hmm. And it said there was a military-industrial complex conspiracy that led to the film being totally removed from the movie theaters by early December 1973 and getting no TV video runs until the 1980s and the mid-1990s when it got legal release and distribution for TV and video.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that's what Regina was talking about.
Oh.
All right, well, thank you, Michelle.
Okay.
Thanks, Michelle.
You're welcome. Good listening to you.
Wow.
All right, talking to you.
Yeah, I never can tell what really caused that, but we were getting
the echo?
A mega echo, indeed, yeah. And
I don't know if it was just in our ears or if it went out over the airwaves.
No.
But,
all right.
Oh, well.
So the other question that I asked, and so DS wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, I also said one of the things when we're talking about wars that I always say to, you know, World War I is thought of as another heroic war that the United States fought in. We lost, I think, like about 140,000 men in just about 10 months. The United States was only in there for
My gosh.
Afghanistan
is now the longest running war in history.
Well, Diaz, looks like he took this raid off of World War. You're talking about World. He's talking about why World War One started in 1914. But I'm saying, why did the U.S. enter World War One? Well, there was two things, primarily. And the first one was the we've talked about how many times.
I think you should talk about it again.
Okay, the so-called Zimmerman Note, no relation to the ultra violence of George Zimmerman. This Zimmerman was the foreign minister of Germany, and the United States had been remaining neutral allegedly, which gets to the second reason. And so Foreign Minister Zimmerman of Germany, of Imperial Germany, wrote to the Mexican government and said, if a war with the United States breaks out between Germany and the United States and you enter on the German side, we will return to you all the land stolen by the United States. Mm. I mean, we do know that, right? I mean, all that California
part,
stuff.
That part we get.
Yeah, and Arizona, New Mexico, what have you, Texas. That was Mexico. I mean, they used to do that back then. You wanted more land, you just send some guys out with guns and
take it. Yeah. Well, it kind of sounds a little bit like Israel and Palestine,
there you
huh?
Go. Yeah. Is that the last? Yeah, I think that's the last land grab war that we've had. So that didn't go over real well. And that, you know, that was sort of a provocation. But do you really want to lose 140,000 Americans over that? What was that Gary Cooper movie? Sergeant York. You ever see that?
Peter, no.
You don't watch a lot of movies.
I don't watch a lot of
old movies. You don't watch Turner Classic?
No.
Okay.
I really don't. I mean, you and I have switched personalities.
Yeah, right. You don't watch anymore.
I don't watch a lot of television.
Yeah.
I watch food-related television because I'm a chef.
You got to come over and see our new television.
I can't believe you got a bigger one.
Well, it's only most people would have these in their bedroom. I got a 39-inch. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nothing. People have like 80-inch televisions now and then.
When I met you, you had a television that I think. When was television invented? Sorry.
The only what sunk us is when they stopped. We just, when Marilyn, almost gave it away. when my wife's mother died, we got this old, big old, what do you call it?
Like a Zenith?
those big old honkers, you know?
Yeah.
And then you couldn't get signals on them anymore. And they said, you had to get cable.
Oh, yeah, when they did the digital thing.
Digital. And I said, I'm not getting cable. And then we tried to do it with a fancy antenna and all that. And finally, I got, and of course, now I'm addicted.
I'm not even going to tell them the show you were watching last night when I called you. My wife's waiting for me. We've got to watch.
Oh, what's it called? The Good Wife?
Yeah. I can't even believe you watch that.
I watch it,
stuff.
Too. Yeah.
Is it bonding time with the wife,
it
or
is.
Do you like it?
No.
Well, I know one thing about it is our friend's daughter played a part on it.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
but that's not why.
Why do you like it?
Well, it's okay. You know, then she watches, kind of shoot 'em ups with me.
Well, that is nice compromise.
Yeah. I'm surprised because she never used to do that.
Well, you know, y'all have been married for 50 years.
Yeah, at least. All right, let's get back to Bangladesh. Hey, remember Concert for Bangladesh?
I do.
Yeah, George Harrison.
George Harrison.
Put that together. Yeah.
Ah, I really miss him. Oh, you know, speaking of that, I mean, I on the rock and roll note, I wanted to make sure I said something. Today is the date. Well, actually, it will be yesterday now. But Sunday, 1991, when we lost Freddie Mercury from Queen. So I'm dedicating this show to Freddie Mercury because I am the biggest Freddie Mercury Queen fan there is. I mean, I'm sure some people would argue with me that they're bigger fans, but you know, that was a sad day,
and the lead guitar. Why can't I think of his name?
Brian May.
Brian May. You know, he's like now like a university professor.
Yeah, and is still rocking. And they have that that cute little Adam Lambert singing with him.
I was trying to look at our Facebook page. It's not opening up for us. But
okay.
So we're talking about Bangladesh, Walmart refusing to contribute to this compensation fund Even though when you think about it, one of the reasons that these retailers have such huge profits is because they're selling us shirts for about what they pay their workers a month. Oh, well, we're not doing it. It's the contractors. But the thing is that Walmart has such incredible buying power that it can dictate what it pays the contractors.
Yeah.
So
and where they purchase everything.
Yeah. So they, the contractors, they'd say, we don't have any choice. If we don't, if we pay anybody more than $38 a month, we're not going to make any money. But apparently the government of Bangladesh is going to announce an increase in the minimum wage for workers in the country's clothing factories. Now it's 38. Man, these guys, where are they going to spend this? Maybe at Walmart's, they open them there. $68 a month.
Oh, my God. That is just criminal.
Yeah.
You know, this is an argument for going to secondhand stores, and I'm going to plug one right now.
Go ahead.
Regeneration in Ferndale. If you have not been to that, check it out. It's the best.
Really?
Best secondhand. I love, I don't know, it makes me feel good to purchase secondhand clothing. You know, I'm not one of these hoity-toity name brand.
You at least look very nice. Well, everything you have on, you got in resale?
A lot of it. Although this name brand coat that I have over here.
Oh, this is the new one?
This is, yeah, but I didn't buy it. My mom bought it for me. And then this is a Coach purse, but it's vintage and it was given to me. I refuse to spend money on handbags and all of that noise. I mean, it's just not in my general makeup.
Well, you know, the other thing is, you haven't been in New York City in a long time, have you?
I haven't.
No, but you can go down to Canal Street. You can get Coach
purse. The knockoffs.
Oh, no, we would not buy counterfeit stuff, but you can buy brand new Coach purses like for $20 and $25.
I remember I went with my mom and they said, come back. We've got special purses in the back room. And they take her in the back room and I'm looking around. Where the hell is Marge? You know, we've lost Marge. I said to my sister, we've lost Marge. They've got her in this back room and they've got a stamp, a Prada stamp, and they're stamping the purse right there.
Really?
Yeah. And she gets out and it's crooked. And she's upset because the stamp is crooked, and she went back into the bag. I'm like, we can't take you to Canal Street anymore.
Every time I go to New York, I always bring back a pashmina scarf.
Yes.
Which probably would cost, what, $100 or something like
that? Yeah.
Except these on Canal Street. Actually, I bought this one on Fifth Avenue, so it was $5.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how I got turned onto Canal Street. And I went back, and I was a friend of mine in New York, and he's, what'd you get? And I said, oh, I got this for her. And he said, what'd you pay? I said, $5. He said, $5? You can get them for $3.50 on Canal Street.
So I had where were they made?
I don't know. Maybe Bangladesh.
I know.
But I had a beautiful scarf, a black and white check scarf that had this beautiful label on it that with a royal crest that made in Scotland, 100% cashmere wool.
Yeah.
And it was like $7.50. Wait a minute. Yeah, $7.50. Yeah, which was the high-priced ones.
Really?
Yeah, I lost it, naturally. We got this. So when you think, oh, well, those people in those countries that are making $38 a month, everything's cheaper there.
I knew you were going to say that because that's what people say.
It's not. It's not true.
It's not true. They are living in poverty. And you consider maybe that's what the father makes and maybe there's a few kids. I mean, really, how in the hell are they surviving?
Well, how about this? A basic diet that meets the needs of a family of three alone costs about $67 a month.
A month. So that's just food.
Yeah. And they're getting 38 a month. And I don't know what to do. Remember, I used to mention this friend of mine whose father was a labor leader, a labor union president.
Mm-hmm.
And when you, in long time, you know, years ago, when you walked into his house, he would grab your shirt, you know, like if you're going out with his daughter.
Oh, he wanted to
make sure you were wearing a Made in America shirt. I'm sure everything he wears now is not Made in America. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's tough. It's tough to find things that are actually made in America. Although there are websites. Remember, there was one like MadeInTheUSA.com. Do you remember hearing that?
Yeah. Sure.
And so I mean, there are. If you Google, you can find it if you work hard enough. Too bad it's a hard work to get that done.
And Royal Oak for women isn't American Apparel.
Oh yeah, but I think that. Well, I heard some of those were closing, but is it still open?
Don't know.
I don't know. But I will say I have a major announcement. You know, I grew up the daughter of a car dealer.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you have like a sex change operation or something.
And I'm pregnant. No. And I'm becoming either, a man. Either I'm going to be a man who's having a baby.
Either one would disappoint your legions of male fans, including me.
Okay, I'm just kidding. I'm not, nothing's changing with me. Now we're, I grew up the daughter of a car dealer. And this was in Des Moines, Iowa. And it was, and don't be mad at me, people, because the end of the story is good. It was all foreign auto, you know, Acura, Honda, Volkswagen, Audi, Infiniti, on and on and on. He owned all these car dealerships. He recently sold them about 4 years ago. And I went home this week to see my family, and I have a tear. My daddy bought a Chevy.
Really?
Yes, he did. I mean, I feel so much better about the about him and everything. And, you know, I don't have an American car. I'm telling you, I'm declaring on Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan, my next car is going to be an American car.
Okay. You know, I can't. Can I say your dad's name?
That's yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wes. I can't imagine Wes in a Chevrolet, though. Wouldn't it be like a Cadillac or?
It's a Chevy SUV.
Oh,
but,
okay.
You know, he does organic farming, and so he needs something. Like, we went out to the organic farm, and we drove around, and we're cruising through the fields in his Chevy.
In Iowa, organic gardening is corn.
No, this is farming. They do garlic and and they have goats and. All kinds of stuff.
All right, your final chance coming right up to get on the air at 248-544-WRIF, and I'll let you know who we're going to have as guests at 1 a.m. Hey, one is a so-called unrepentant terrorist.
You are such a radical, Peter.
Right back.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Let me tell you about Charity Motors. If you're looking for a 2013 tax deduction, it's got to be Charity Motors, and here's why. This late in the year, if you donate your car to somebody else, you'll only be able to write off their sale price at the time of the sale. And at this point, it's most likely not going to sell by the end of the year, which means you're going to have to wait to write it off on your 2014 taxes. On top of that, the amount you write off is going to be a lot less than the fair market value. Not with Charity Motors. They're different. They're the only car donation program in Michigan who can guarantee the full fair market value tax deduction at the time of donation. Not when the car sells. Because Charity Motors is the only car donation program that sells your car only to low-income people who really need it. And, of course, it's only Charity Motors that allows you to pick the charity of your choice to receive the proceeds from your car donation. Get your fair market value tax deduction for 2013 guaranteed. Call them today at 888-908-CARS. They'll even pick up the car for you. Call Charity Motors right now at 888-908-CARS. Call Charity Motors for a guaranteed 2013 full fair market value tax deduction. CharityMotors.org.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, 248-544-WRIF, 248-544-9743.
Hey, good job, Peter.
I did it for you, yeah. I'm looking at our Facebook page, and Jalene's computer is down, so we don't have a lot of stuff posted. Although there's,
I'm getting a new one, yay!
There's this incredible story on there, and it says, it starts off sort of wrong-headed. It's from the Ed Show. It's Ed Schultz on MSNBC.
I deleted that, didn't I?
You know, I told you, I asked you to delete it, because I thought it was just on there by mistake. But actually, what it's about is the Moo Cluck Moo restaurant.
And we're getting another one.
Another one what?
Moo Cluck Moo. We have one here in Detroit, and another one is opening.
Oh, we have one in Dearborn Heights.
And another one is opening.
Really?
Somewhere.
Because on the Ed Show, the owner.
Tell us.
Now, what is Moo Cluck Moo? It's just really a fast food restaurant that do a lot of burgers, and they're really inexpensive, like
$3. But they're politically correct. What is it?
$15 an hour they pay their fast food workers.
That's incredible.
When they started, they were doing $12 an hour. And then when the movement among fast food workers that said they want nationally to have a $15 an hour minimum wage. Imagine that, $15 an hour in Bangladesh, Walmart.
This microphone is so screwed up.
Can you, like, turn it off rather than making all that noise with it?
You know you like it.
Yeah. So they're paying $15 an hour. And let me see if I can quickly...
Has anyone been to the Mu Cluck Mu? I want to know about this place.
Yeah, I have to... Mu Cluck Mu. Where is this in here? Oh, man, I can't find it. That's too bad. Oh, here it is. If you give a cluck about workers... on behalf of the Michigan Coalition for Human Rights, I invite you to join the Michigan Coalition on Human Rights and Friends over Thanksgiving weekend and saying, workers, thank you, Mu Cluck Mu. It's a little hole-in-the-wall eatery on this person's corner in Dearborn Heights. They pay $15 an hour.
They serve organic fast food. I'm reading this on my phone, by the way.
Oh, okay.
They serve organic fast food.
So they're asking folks to stop by for a meal over Thanksgiving weekend as a show of gratitude and join a pick-it. I don't know.
Not pick-it, a pick-it line.
P-I-C-K-I-T, whatever that means. Line on Saturday, November 30th from 1 to 3 p.m. A portion of the proceeds over the weekend will be given to the people who feed hundreds of forgotten workers and friends every other week in Cass Park.
And that's on Sundays in Cass.
Yeah, down at in front of the Masonic Temple.
Yeah, it's something I can never attend because I'm always on the air, yeah. but one of these days.
Speaking of on the air, let's go back to our phones and pick up John. John is
okay, now you can do it. When that red thing is on there, that means our producer's talking to him.
Okay. But thank
now you.
You
can.
Here is John in Farmington Hills. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. It's great to talk to you, and I was just telling your call screener that you've got a powerful voice, and I'm hoping you could take a stand with me on this one because it's just so final, and I understand doing damage control and things like that, but when it comes to Iran, and to borrow a phrase from the Beatles, the fool on the hill, John Kerry, wanting to... say, well, you know, if they get a nuclear bomb, and at least China and Russia know the finalism of the half-life being 100,000 years of radiation, but from my understanding, they would love to use something like that and bring down the 12th imam and then have this wonderful type of a utopia.
No, wait a minute. Where do you get all this from? I mean, this is kind of almost like a cartoon of them. I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, that's one of the problems with having religion co-joined with the state. When I think of one nation under God, I think of Iran. And that's, you know, exactly what we don't want. So, these guys running Iran are practical politicians. And what they put out with all of that is probably consumption for the masses. So the idea that they would get a nuclear weapon and then precipitate its use, I don't think has much basis, in fact.
He's waiting for you. Yeah. Sometimes they're waiting for you to continue talking.
Go ahead.
Do you have a response, John?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really felt when they said they wanted to wipe Israel off the map, and they got three of our people right now, and they won't let them go, and Kerry's wanting to give them $8 million when the sanctions were finally biting. That's the only time they've ever come to the table to even talk, as far as I looked at Iran's history.
Well, it gets back to what I said, though. The real danger is not from Iran having nuclear weapons. It's Pakistan, I would say, is probably the most apt to use it, as would India, as would Israel, as would, the people that would actually use them, including the United States, Britain, and France and the United States, even though we did use them unnecessarily in World War II. What really has to begin as a starting point is that of complete nuclear disarmament. Once these military guys leave the military establishment in the United States, they all start saying we should be reducing nuclear weapons. There's still a large threat hanging over our heads just between us and Russia. There are weapons that could be pointed. Oh, what did I write?
Wait, they are.
Yeah, they are. Well, I mean, they are pointed, and they all have to be put on alert. I forgot, or did I put that on the list? China also has nuclear weapons. No, I didn't mention that. So I don't think Iran should have nuclear weapons, but I don't think the United States should. I don't think Israel should.
No one to abolish nuclear weapons.
Yeah,
period.
And there's no movement on the part of any of these other countries. And we know that if you have nuclear weapons, it's a hedge against being invaded. And Iran, hey, they've had some bad things happen over the last couple hundred years to them by the hands of the West. So one can, I think, understand without supporting, which I don't support, why they would want to have nuclear weapons. But okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
I mean, they're not going to just sit there and say, you know what, you're right. You guys have them. We're going to, we are sorry. Well, it looks like we have, to ADD on into, it looks like we have a call about Moo Cluck Moo.
Moo Cluck Moo, the fast food restaurant. $15 an hour.
Organic burgers.
Hey, Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, I do Moo Cluck Moo once or twice a week.
Oh, really?
Always good. Grass-fed beef, free-range chicken. The soda, which I don't really drink, instead of the high fructose corn syrup stuff, they got the stuff made with cane sugar.
Really?
Yeah, I hope people flood them with business so they can get a bigger place.
I do, too. Now, let me ask you a question. How do the workers seem? Do they seem happier than your average fast food worker?
Well, you know, they're busy. The place is cramped. They really need a bigger restaurant.
Well, they're opening a new one. I read it in the Free Press today, but I can't remember where it is.
I think it's up in Oakland County. I was in there. I heard them talking about it when I was in there last time. I think it's up in Waterford they're talking
about. Well, I am going to Moo Cluck Moo. That's it. Peter, you want to come
have
a burger with
we'll
me?
We'll do it. They even have...
They have veggie burgers?
They have a mushroom burger.
Okay.
Made out of mushrooms.
Yummy.
Right, a big portobello burger or something. Mm. Like
hey, Tom, how big is the hamburger's like $3. Okay. Is it very large?
Yeah, it's just like... It's pretty average size. I don't know if it's a quarter pound, but you can go that, or you can just get a double, and it's $5. And if you want to throw the cheese and bacon fat on there, it's another buck.
Wow. All right.
Nothing wrong with a little cheese and bacon, my friend.
Yeah, you always feel like you've eaten something good after you left. You
know? Absolutely. Well, we'll make it down there. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate the report. All right.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bye now. And if you're just joining us, Moo Cluck Moo.
It's actually, a burger joint.
I mentioned this to somebody, and they said, it's what, Chinese food?
Oh, God.
I mean, they were, you know.
Well, they thought it was like MU.
Yeah.
Something, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you were talking about you were going to buy an American car next, and your pop, who had sold foreign cars all his life, just bought a Chevrolet. Here's Corey in Rochester wants to talk about American cars.
We're changing our ways, Corey.
How you doing? Yeah, I'm a total American car. I love American cars.
Yeah.
That's really all I've owned. But I find it upsetting that a foreign car is all American. Saying made might be a little different. It's made in America fully, like Toyota.
Yeah.
Like the Camry is all built and made and manufactured here.
Yeah.
But we ship Ford parts overseas. It's made there. We ship it back. And then we say it's built.
Right, like India.
Yeah, I find it upsetting that way.
Yeah, my car actually was made in Marysville, Ohio, so I have less guilt about it. And it's a hybrid, so I'm kind of saving the environment a little bit, so a little bit less guilt. But I understand what you're saying, because there's big business with these other countries when it comes to the American American car companies.
Well, the other thing, I thought I'd be a good American consumer, so I went out and bought a Ford Fusion, which then turns out to be built in... Mexico!
Peter, you're bad.
Which is upsetting.
Yeah.
It's more or less saving money, I understand, but the satisfaction of knowing it's built in America completely.
I sure didn't save any particular money. I mean, I did some from, you get a deal from the dealer, but it's not like they're $8,000 or something.
Yeah.
And I never understood, because the UAW, the United Auto Workers, has been very supportive of a lot of Mexican labor unions, why they haven't made more of an effort to organize Mexican auto workers. I have no idea what's going on with that. And Bob King, who is now the retired UAW president, or will be soon, I mean, he's all about doing organizing. All right, my friend, thank you for calling in.
I want to know who's chewing our producer's ear off on that phone.
They're lucky they don't have
Jefferson, if they're being mean to you, get rid of them.
No, I don't think so. There used to be this one producer that we never could figure out, pardon me, why he was taking so long with all these calls. And he was making dates.
He was?
With the women that called him.
I don't remember. We've had so many through the years. In fact, I was one.
You were.
And then you let me on in here and let me on this mic.
And the rest is hysteria.
And then it all went downhill from there.
You mentioned this is, you know, hey, romance blooms, doesn't it? Charles Manson.
Oh, yes.
Getting married.
This is a great way to end the show. Charles Manson.
We're not ending.
Well, in a few minutes,
yeah,
we are. Yeah. I mean, you know, to wind down the show, let's say that. We could talk about the condom contest. but, yeah, good old Charlie Manson. He is getting married to a 25-year-old named Star.
Not the woman from the, what's that woman's program on?
Like Star Jones. So she's been off that show forever.
Oh, yeah?
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what I know.
So Charles Manson may be getting married, it says, or at least that's what one of his biggest fans claims. She says, I'll tell you straight up, Charlie and I are going to get married, the supposed fiancé, known only as Star, told Rolling Stone. I take it very seriously. Charlie is my husband. Charlie told me to tell you this. Now, Charles Manson is now 79 years old.
Yeah, but it said that she sees him
every weekend.
But didn't you get it was like, could it be conjugal? No.
But I don't know.
They wouldn't. Yeah, how would you like to make it with a guy with a swastika on his forehead?
You want to vomit just thinking about it. Charlie, however, has a different story. That's a bunch of garbage. That's trash. That's how he talks, you know. Manson told Rolling Stone, we're just playing that for public consumption.
Yeah.
Star, who received her name from Manson.
Oh, my God.
What a joy.
That's how it started.
She operates a website called, and I don't even care if I'm giving this out, Release Charles Manson Now.
Yeah, there's a good chance of that.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
He's been in jail for 40 years.
He has. And didn't he record, like, an album in?
I don't know, but he did record an album.
When I'm home and I'm showing my dad this story, then it morphed into the Charles family, Manson family singers, and we started looking up on YouTube Manson family. Like songs, and I was playing them songs, and he was, poor old man, he was going right along with me.
You know what
home
is?
Home is where you're happy. That's a Manson family singer song.
Really?
Yes!
You know what his favorite song was?
What?
Helter Skelter by the Beatles.
Oh, yeah. Is that why they called, that there was a movie about him called Helter Skelter?
Well, there was a book, too, by
and a book.
Vincent Bugliosi.
Oh, yes, yeah, the former prosecutor in the...
L.A., wasn't it?
Yeah, but what he did the really big, in that trial.
Yeah, he prosecuted Manson.
He prosecuted Manson.
Yeah.
And he's a friend of the show.
You know, that's interesting.
And he did an album called The Greatest Latin Love Songs of All Time. I own it. He sent it to me.
Bugliosi did.
Bugliosi sent it to me.
Not Manson. Yeah. By the way, people got to remember, some people listening were born like in the 1990s. This happened in the 1960s.
But doesn't everyone know about Charles Manson?
I don't
know.
I never make any assumption. Charles Manson and his family.
All his bitches.
Yeah. And some guys, they went off on this murder spree.
He orchestrated it, but he never did it. He got these people to do his dirty work. And there was Sharon Tate, who was...
Movie star.
She was married to Roman Polanski.
Right, the director.
Didn't he later, like, kill a kid?
He was doing it with, like, a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
And for a long time couldn't come back to the United States.
But she was pregnant, and whichever one of those crazy women, they stabbed her to death. And then wrote a fork.
Yeah.
And then wrote pigs in blood on the wall.
Because they were rich.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they were.
Hey, you know, we have disdain for the ultra-wealthy, like the fat cats on Wall Street, but we just talk about it. This guy's out of his gourd.
So, here's the deal. Bill and Melinda Gates, their foundation, they have a contest to create a condom that men would actually use.
Well, isn't that what what? Are you saying men don't like to wear them?
What time is it?
We've already had this conversation.
Yeah, we can. Now, how do you think that sounds?
What?
It's like we've had that conversation. I go, and you go say, oh, we've had that conversation.
Oh, about men.
What do you think people think?
Well, I'm talking about men, people we know.
Okay. This is not about Jolene and me.
What? Why are you getting all defensive?
I don't want people to get the wrong idea about either of us.
Well, but people already do have it. One guy called and said he thought for the last 3 years we were married.
Oh, wow. Well, here it says the condom of the future might be made of cow tendon or fish skin. Oh, that'd make me want to put it on. But
yuck.
Don't you think, the best way to get men to wear condoms is for a woman to insist?
Yes.
Yeah. But they think if they really get these things. But what they do is they aim to decrease unintended pregnancies. Good idea. And you would think that all the who would really be behind this would be the anti-abortion people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because unwanted pregnancies.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. And also you would think that they would be all about free distribution of condoms.
Yeah. And this the cow intestine, is that what it is?
Yeah.
I guess it's really thick is why.
No, they don't want thick. They want really, really thin.
But you know what I mean? That's why it's foolproof.
In here. No, it's collagen fibers from the cow's Achilles tendons.
Yuck. That's so weird.
Yeah. You got to put that on your private parts.
Yeah.
Then it kind of penetrates a private part. Hey, what is this? Here's this guy. They're unbelievably strong, says Mr. McLaughlin, whoever that is, who currently gets beef tendon from a Vietnamese grocery. He said,
what?
He doesn't mean, we're going to just have to end on ceremony.
What? Can't read it. You can't tease people like this, including me.
I could yank all day. Now break this thing. Folks, we gotta go.
Yank away.
Yeah. All right.
Hey, we are going to be on the air next weekend, even though it's a holiday weekend.
Yeah.
Unless they have some kind of special that we don't know about, but I'm pretty sure we're going to be on.
And if you want to see our tank.
Or our yank.
Our tank. I can't do it. Our take on Thanksgiving. Go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, or we'll have all this posted on our Facebook page tomorrow. Bill Ayers, the so-called unrepentant terrorist that Sarah Palin accused of palling around with Barack Obama, he's next. So have a great weekend. Jefferson, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jefferson. We apologize for the ending of the show.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Hey, music lovers. Tired of your music buffering while you're running around? Here's a reality check. Verizon's 4G LTE is the most reliable and in more places than any other 4G network. Reliability you can believe in. That's powerful. Verizon. Click on the banner to compare the maps.
Jeez, Q. It's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch.
The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
Mm-mm, no.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
101 WRIF.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, you're on.
The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If I said I was going to do a show on education and introduced William Ayers, who's recently retired as a distinguished professor of education and senior university scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, who's written books including To Teach, Teaching Towards Freedom, A Kind and Just Parent, it would be a hell of an interesting show. And probably not a lot of you would remember or know who William Ayers is. But if I said Bill Ayers, the author of Fugitive Days, a man connected with the long-ago organization called the Weather Underground, who wrote Fugitive Days, who became inexplicably a central figure in the 2008 presidential election when Sarah Palin said Bill Ayers is someone that an unrepentant terrorist who Barack Obama is palling around with. And if you've heard me introduce Bill before, I often say he's somebody who I'm pleased and proud always to say that I've palled around with. And so, Bill Ayers, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's my pleasure to pal around with you anytime.
And the new book, pardon me, is called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And one of the things that struck me is you could have very well just let all of this go away. And, I mean, because you became the central figure in American discourse after 9/11 when your book, Fugitive Days, came out right on 9/11. And then all of this hullabaloo about 2008 and you being an unrepentant terrorist. And you could just, I don't know, you must have a garden somewhere. You could just tend that. Why bring this all back up again?
Well, in a way, I was disinclined to write a sequel to Fugitive Days, and my publisher had been after me to do it for a long, long time. I mean, Fugitive Days ends in 1975, and I probably wouldn't have done anything except that the 2008 campaign came along, and suddenly I was thrust unwittingly and unwillingly into this narrative about the presidential candidate, Barack Obama, at the time. And I got stirred to wanting to kind of respond, wanting to say something about it. And as I wrote, the interesting thing to me is that as I wrote, I really realized that the book was much more about parenting and teaching than I would have ever predicted. But that's actually what I've done for 40 years. And the book, I guess the theme is, you know, how does one stay true to the passions that were ignited when you were a young person, the values, the hopes, the dreams, in a changing landscape and over a long lifetime? And that's really the theme of the book. Public Enemy, of course, is meant to be an ironic title, not a real descriptor. But so that's the book we kind of ended up with.
Well, it some of it in here is surprising. Like I said, it's a great family story about your own family and the young man that you raised now into adulthood and, you know, fine group of children. So it is about parenting. I mean, talking about preschool and all that. I was very surprised to find this. But let me get at some of the more controversial things. I was surprised that on page 181, you said, stay a weatherman. I will, I am. And a weatherman, to people that may not remember or are too young to remember, there was something called the Weather Underground that carried out a series of, was it something like 20-plus bombings of corporate and government targets in the 1970s as a way of opposing the war in Vietnam that ended in 1975, and then other corporate targets that had been doing some pretty awful things. So does that mean that Bill Ayers actually is an unrepentant terrorist?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I've never accepted the label terrorist. And I should correct one thing you said in the beginning. You mentioned that Sarah Palin thrust me into this role.
Oh, you're right.
The reality is it was Hillary Clinton during the primary when people were trying to figure out how to run against this talented, charismatic, brilliant young senator from Illinois. Hillary Clinton lit on the narrative, and the narrative was, we don't know much about this guy. He's certainly talented and beautiful, but what do we really know? He's a mystery. But look at his friends. And then they thrust up Jeremiah Wright, the fiery black nationalist preacher, so-called, and the Palestinian scholar Rashid Khalidi, and me, and we were all, and then I was the unrepentant domestic terrorist. All three of those are caricatures, of course, and they're not real people. They're cartoon characters. But the real disturbing part of that narrative was the guilt by association. It's not just that he knew Jeremiah Wright, but that he had to, because of that association, he had to own Jeremiah Wright's politics, history, experience, and so on. So that just to correct that. But then in my view, I'm not.
But wait. Let's go back to this. Yeah. Actually, it was, and I didn't know this. That it was Sarah Palin who made the statement about you were that
palling around. Yeah, I love that deathless phrase.
I love it.
Fantastic.
Sarah Palin said that Barack Obama was palling around with Bill Ayers, my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. His brand new book is Public Enemy: Confessions of American Dissident. But George Stephanopoulos, during a Democratic debate, he brought that up. Do you think he was just carrying water for Hillary Clinton?
Oh, without a doubt. I don't think there's any question. The day before, he was on the Sean Hannity show, and Hannity had been pushing this line for a long time. And Hannity said, are you going to ask him about that? And George Stephanopoulos said, well, I'm taking notes right now, Sean. But if you remember, George Stephanopoulos was in the Clinton White House. He was a very close friend of Hillary Clinton's. And I don't think there's any question that this, and clearly they were prepared for it. I mean, Hillary Clinton followed up in the debate with another slicing cut on this same issue, and she never let go of it. She didn't win on it. She was defeated on it, but that didn't stop McCain Palin from picking up the same narrative and driving it as far as they could. It was a silly thing, and I think to our credit, to the credit of the voters, it didn't stick, and it didn't seem to do much. It wasn't what people were most concerned about or were voting on. But back to the question of being unrepentant.
Sure.
I mean, the piece you just read, that last sentence, is from a little bit that I wrote about the question of apologies in American public life and what one is supposed to apologize for. And you and I go way, way back, and you knew me when I was a teacher, and you knew me when I was a student for Democratic Society leader. But you know, in my mind, what I'm saying that I'm not sorry for is not everything. I mean, I'm 68 years old. You can't be 18 and not have regrets. But what I am saying is that the war in Vietnam was a war of aggression. It was a war of occupation. It was a genocidal assault on a whole people. And we did everything we could to hurl ourselves against that war. I regret nothing that I did hurling myself against that war. And to say, yes, but you broke the law, that's true. I broke the law often. I was arrested dozens of times. And to say I crossed lines of common sense, or as presidential candidate Obama said, you know, I committed detestable acts. That's possible too, but here was the situation. 6,000 people a week were being murdered by my government. I set out to be an organizer against the war. By 1968, a majority of Americans opposed the war, and yet the war dragged on. What do you do? In my own family, one of my brothers joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. One of my brothers was part of the mass migration to Canada to desert and to oppose the war in that way. I was part of this illegal organization that committed extreme acts of vandalism. And after the accidental killing of our own three people who killed themselves making a bomb, no one was hurt or injured. And so I have a hard time regretting destroying property on a given day when 6,000 people were being murdered that week. That's what I'm saying I'm not willing to apologize for. Although, as you know, you read the book, I do propose that we have a truth and reconciliation process. I think one of the reasons that Vietnam continues to animate so much of our conversation and so much of our political life is because we've never come to grips with what really happened there as a nation. And so we can have these false narratives like John McCain was a war hero. There's no truth to that. There's nothing honest about that. And until we as a country are able to kind of face our history, face it honestly, try to come to terms with it, not to come to a single conclusion, but to go on a quest, a journey seeking the truth, I think we will be unresolved.
Bill Ayers is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. His brand new book is called Public Enemy: Confessions of an American Dissident. It's published by Beacon Press. You go to Bill's website. It's Bill Ayers, AYERS.org. He also has a Facebook page, which you can find. There'll be a link on my page as well, PeterWerbe.com. So 2008, the election's going on. First Hillary Clinton and then Sarah Palin and John McCain are trying to hook you up as somehow connected with very intricately with Barack Obama. And I knew all that, but I had no idea until I read Public Enemy that the consequences on you and your life to the point where you had to have a police guard.
Well, I'm not sure I had to have a police guard. I didn't ask for one, but Mayor Daley at some point felt that the threats that were coming in were just too vivid and too worrisome. And the University of Illinois, where I was a professor, felt the same way. So I had a university police officer who kind of sat outside my door. Nothing much came of it. The threats were, you know, I envision the people who threaten me or who write me these angry emails as kind of middle-aged men with too much time on their hands and sitting in their mother's basement drinking scotch and venting. That's how I imagine it. I had one incident where a guy showed up at my office and threatened me, but it's pretty rare. And anyway, I don't think you can live your life, you know, in a state of in a bunker mentality. So I don't do that. I am pretty open. I speak openly. One of the interesting things since 2008 is I have never given a talk since 2008 at a university where I'm not picketed by the Tea Party or confronted by organized right-wing people. And yet I find that even that kind of stimulating. I have a whole section in the book called Talking to the Tea Party, which I've enjoyed immensely. I have to tell you, it's not as crazy as you might think. But the threats are more nutty than worrisome. I haven't worried much about it.
Well, during the 2008 campaign, and you had a police guard, I found that pretty interesting because certainly the Chicago police, known for their brutality, for instance, just in general, but also the 1968 Democratic Party convention. You can even hear Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young singing about it. And certainly when the weathermen, a group you were part of, carried out what was called the Days of Rage. People can just Google that if they don't know what that is. Very, very interesting occurrence. But the Chicago police were certainly your public enemies, but you're, all of a sudden you're being guarded by them, and they had thought erroneously that you had done more than you had actually taken some lives. Can you tell us that little incident?
There were many, many interesting things. I mean, I live in this small neighborhood in Chicago called Hyde Park, and that's where Barack Obama happens to live as well as Jesse Jackson, Harold Washington, Gwendolyn Brooks. It's a fascinating neighborhood. But so I know the cops. I see them at the coffee shop, and I have no romantic vision of the police as a force for either justice or good in our weirdly stratified and racist society. On the other hand, a lot of the cops in Chicago are young. Many are female. Many are African-American or Latino. And I know them from the coffee shop. So one day, one of the young cops who I see all the time said to me, so Bill, you guys did kill cops back in the day, right? And I said, my heart dropped. And I said, no, absolutely not. There was a lot of heated rhetoric, but nothing like that happened. And he said, I thought so, but a bunch of the guys in the station house are reading your book, and we've been debating that. So they're sitting in the station house reading Fugitive Days, and that's killing me. It's cracking me up. He said, would you mind coming over to the station house and having a book talk? And I thought, my God, what world am I living in, you know? Actually, the book ends, you may remember, the book ends in Grant Park with Obama accepting the victory that he had won in November of 2008, and I was overwhelmed to be there with a million people, not because I thought that the world was exactly going to change, but because that night, with a million hopeful people of all ages and races and classes, not an angry confrontation, but in a kind of a soft, sweet mood, I just loved it. And this one cop came up to me late in the night because I was kind of the last person out of the park, and he said, come on, Bill, it's time to go. And I say in the book, you know, I knew that someday we may face each other over an angry barricade, but not tonight. And so I ended up saying, I love you, man, and he said, I love you back.
Wow.
And it was kind of a touching, surreal, and ironic moment.
In a different way, we can remember Bob Dylan's song, The Times They Are A-Changin'.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, I didn't have any illusions even that night. I mean, I don't think that that in a world as broken and out of balance as this world, that we can solve it by electing somebody or that a leader will come along to save us. And I remember saying even that night, Barack Obama won't save us, but perhaps with a little luck, people like us can save Barack Obama. And what I meant by that is that real change that means something to the quest for social justice, to the quest for equality and fairness and peace and democracy. Real social justice comes from fire from below. It doesn't come from, it's never granted from above. So Lyndon Johnson passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, but he wasn't part of the Black Freedom Movement. Abraham Lincoln never belonged to an abolitionist party. They are remembered for these things because of fire from below. And that's what I have access to, and that's what you have access to. We don't have access to the White House, and increasingly we don't have access to the Congress, which is little more than a kind of auction house anymore. But we do have access to the street, the neighborhood, the community, the school, the classroom, the workplace. That's where we ought to be organizing, and that's where we ought to have our voices heard. So I was at a university last night, and, you know, people say, do you think Obama will make peace here and there? And I say, look, the question isn't what did Obama do today to bring us peace. The question is, what did you do today to bring us peace? Because that's where peace comes from.
Absolutely. Bill Ayers is my guest. His brand new book is called Public Enemy. Pardon me, Confessions of an American Dissident. His former book was Fugitive Days, so this is another memoir. Bill Ayers figured heavily, at least on the Republican side, in the 2008 election. Sarah Palin continually denounced him. Bill Ayers got death threats, and this was to show that Barack Obama had a murky and perhaps radical past. There's a friend of mine, a great singer-songwriter, who I was just in Dallas with over the weekend, David Rovics. You can go to davidrovics.com, R-O-V-I-C-S, where he sings all these, you know, they said if Obama gets in, he's going to do, and just this laundry list of radical things.
Wonderful.
And then the chorus is, if only it was true.
Yeah, exactly.
But here, and I know you've had to talk about this about 110 times before, but there was a number of allegations that came out in 2008, and one is that you had written Barack Obama's books. And I mean, there's something inherently racist in that. You know?
I think there is.
But go ahead. Did you write Barack Obama's books?
Well, what I said, you know, that's an accusation that still goes around on the right wing blogs, just like the birth certificate goes around and all these kind of crazy things. But I never really answered that question until the election passed, and then I ran into a right wing blogger in Washington Reagan Airport, and she came up to me and introduced herself as a right wing blogger, and she said, if you would just answer one question. I said, sure. And she said, did you write Barack Obama's dreams for my father? And I just had an inspiration at that moment, a flash, and I said to her, will you report this accurately? And she said she would. And I said, well, yes, I wrote every word of Dreams for My Father, and if you can help me prove it, I'll split the royalties with you. And she put it on her blog. Her blog became the hottest hit for that week until Rush Limbaugh reined her in, and he said, look, he's pulling your leg. He's making fun of you. And what struck me as so amusing about that is that, you know, if they are intrepid, you know, investigative reporters discovering that I wrote Obama's memoir, then good for them. But if I admit it, then I must be pulling their leg. So somewhere in there is the murky truth. But the fact is, Obama's an inspired writer, a brilliant speaker. But he also is, and this is critical, which I think you know and understand, and most of your listeners probably do as well. When he was asked during the campaign to describe his politics, he said, I'm a middle-of-the-road, pragmatic, compromising politician. I get things done. And the right wing looked at him and said, no, he's a secret socialist, secret Muslim, pals around with terrorists, a foreigner, all of those things, many of which are tinged with racism. And the left wing looked at him and said, he's winking in our direction. But it isn't true. He has always been exactly as he advertises himself. Even more telling than that, When he was asked during the primary, who would Martin Luther King support? He said, King wouldn't support any of us. He'd be in the streets building a movement for justice. That strikes me as something that only a community organizer could understand and say, but it also strikes me as good instruction for the rest of us. That's where we should be, in the streets building a movement for justice, not begging the King to get things right, because he won't.
Blair's during the 2008 election was also accused, actually Barack Obama was accused of palling around, that phrase that, how did you describe it, Bill, as?
Deathless. It's a deathless phrase.
Deathless, yeah. I still think the program you suggested, let's go there first.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. I'm surprised. Go ahead. I'm surprised.
Well, I contacted Sarah Palin's people pretty early on, and I said, we should have a TV show. I think it would be good for either Fox or MSNBC, and it could be called Palin Around with Sarah and Bill. And we could have guests like, whoever, and we could talk politics. But she didn't find it amusing and never responded.
I think she missed the boat. Would you have actually have done it?
Oh, absolutely. I have more fun when I debate right-wingers. You know, a lot of students and colleagues at the university always feel fearful of this kind of thing. I think it's the essence of democracy, is not only to talk to strangers, but to have real discourse across real divisions. And here's what's shocking, and it's in my book around this kind of section of about talking to the Tea Party. Again and again, Tea Party people come to my talks and end up saying to me afterwards in question and answer often, I agree with you more than I thought I possibly could, because they think I'm going to be some kind of, breathing fire and light beams coming out of my eyes. It turns out I'm a 68-year-old retired professor, but I do think about, and I am a radical. Yes, I am a radical, and I think, that we need to radically transform our society. I think we need a revolution in values in order to have a revolution in fact. But I'm not, that doesn't mean I'm beyond talking. In fact, I have believed my whole life that on the 10 most important issues that I care about, I'm not a barricaded minority in this country. I'm in the broad majority on the question of peace, on the question of surveillance, on the question of human rights and gay and queer rights. I'm in the majority. I don't buy that I'm a minority. So I try to act that way and conduct myself that way.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who say, I want to just get rid of the divisions of left and right and Democrat and Republican, and to some extent it doesn't even seem possible. But I did hear Tom Hartman, my colleague talk show host, just today saying essentially the same thing that you did about that he thinks that the Tea Party and the Occupy movement share a lot of common space.
That's probably true, and I've talked with Tom many times, and I think we do agree on this. The thing I would be cautious about is there's a deep strain in the Tea Party movement. There's two strains that we have to worry about. One is they are a funded movement by the likes of the Koch brothers, and that's not something that's kind of independent and insurgent from below. And so they're anti-government, but they are definitely not anti-corporate. And so they've come part of the way, but not far enough. And the other problem is that the strain of racism and white supremacy that runs deep in our political history, in fact, it's at the core of our political history, is not something that the mainstream Tea Party folks have taken on or been willing to confront.
You know, Bill, it's interesting you said, as I had read in your book, I do, I don't know, maybe 80 interviews a year, and I maybe read two or three books in advance. Sometimes I don't even crack them. I just kind of give these investigative questions because I want to know. But I did read this all the way through.
Oh, I'm delighted.
The book is Public Enemy: Confessions of an American Dissident. But you've written so many other books about education and parenting and others around that. And you can go to Bill's website, Bill Ayers, A-Y-E. ERS.org. Is there another political memoir possible, or have you exhausted it all?
I tend to think I've exhausted it, but you never know. The book I'm working on now, you're right. I mean, mostly I write about education and about kids and about kids in crisis, but the book I'm working on now is tentatively titled What If? And the subtitle is Releasing the Radical Imagination. Because I think one of the things missing in the discourse is, what's the alternative? And we need to think way, way, way outside the frames that we're given if we're going to come up with anything like a sustainable future. And so I'm writing a very short book with maybe 10 chapters reimagining or reframing the important issues of the day. What if we closed all foreign military bases? What if we shut down the Pentagon? What if we abolished the prisons and the borders? Crazy ideas, but ideas that I think have a certain practicality at the same time.
You know, we've got about 30 seconds left. A huge question. Are you optimistic about the future? I can get pretty pessimistic.
No, I'm not pessimistic. I you know, I sometimes consider myself an optimist of the heart and a pessimist of the brain. I would say to you that both pessimists and optimists think they know what's coming, and I'm certain I don't know what's coming. I think the future is completely in play. I think we're living in a history that's dynamic and in the making, and that makes me hopeful. Not optimistic, but I get up every morning saying, today we can do it. And if I didn't get up that way, I'd be too tired to get out of bed because so much is wrong. On the other hand, you don't know how it's going to turn out. I don't know how it's going to turn out. The day before Occupy, we didn't see it coming. The day before Rosa Parks sat in on the bus, we didn't see it coming. Those things happened. And who the hell knows what's going to happen later today?
Great. Bill Ayers has been my guest. His brand new book is called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. His last book, Fugitive Days, in terms of being a memoir, is a worthy read as well. You can go to his website, which is Bill Ayers, AYERS.org. You can find him on Facebook. There'll be a link to all of this at my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And Bill, we've got a pal around soon.
Okay, good, man. It's a pleasure to hear your voice, and keep up the good work.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. I think it's been said a lot of times that the so-called recovery from the Bush-Reaganomics recession of the last few years has occurred, although along with it, it's been kind of jobless, that there's still millions of people unemployed. And this is a phenomena going across the world. And the ups and downs, the boom and bust of capitalism is nothing new. This has been happening ever since the system came into being. But when it hits you as an individual, when you wind up unemployed, when suddenly the rug is pulled out from under you and all your plans and your dreams, your financial security, your sense of self-worth, it's pretty tough. Well, I'd like to examine this whole question. A very interesting book that's come my way. The author is Ofer Sharon, and Ofer Sharon teaches at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology at their Sloan School of Management. He's the assistant professor of work and employment relations. We're reaching him at his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The name of the book is Flawed System, Flawed Self, Job Searching and Unemployment Experiences. And it's a pleasure to welcome Ofer Sharon. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
This is an odd question. I hadn't intended to ask this, but have you ever been in the position of being the job searcher, or have you always just been able to sort of research and study it?
I of course had to job search like everybody to get my current job, to get jobs that I had prior to academia, but I have never been in the position of not finding a job for 6 months or longer, which makes it a completely different experience. It's one thing to look for work while you're currently working. It's a completely different one to be looking for work when your entire material basis for living is in question.
Now, your book is called Flawed System, Flawed Self. Let's go for the first part of the title. What's the flawed system here? Is it the capitalism itself? Is it the job system? Is it, what is it?
The title refers to the two ways that job seekers understand why they're having difficulties finding work. One way to look at it is there's a flawed system. The hiring system is not giving me a fair chance, or there are not enough jobs. Another way to look at it is there's something wrong with me. And what I found very striking in my research when I talked to unemployed job seekers in the United States and in Israel is a pattern where so many American, particularly white-collar job seekers, ended up feeling like the problem was internal. something is wrong with me. They blame themselves. Even when there was a great recession happening and unemployment was headlines, the experience of job searching is very individuating and creates a sense that something is wrong with you. I'm happy to talk more about that. But in Israel, the experience was quite different. There, the unemployed job seekers increasingly came to a conclusion that the system of hiring is flawed, that the economic system is not giving them a fair chance, that no one is really seeing their potential and capacities, and that they're getting excluded.
Now, if you have a situation, let's look at the first way of reacting, that it's my fault, is a flawed self, the second part of your title, a flawed system, flawed self. One could say, well, look, everybody didn't get fired. 93% of people are working. What's wrong with me? I mean, it is an easy road to individuate, as I think you said, or am I making up the word? But whatever, that you can look at it that it's an individual failing or a flaw.
It is easy to fall into that, particularly in the American job search context. So it's interesting. We don't always take this individualistic perspective. When actually the example you gave about layoffs, when I ask people, so what happened on your last job? How come you're not working there anymore? Almost all people answer that, giving me structural external explanations. There was a layoff. There was outsourcing. There was a merger. Something that outside of themselves, an external force that they could understand led to their job loss. Not that that, you know, made it a happy circumstance, but it wasn't typically something about them. This frame of understanding shifted over time. When they began to look for work, the sense that they had about the new question, not why I lost my job, but why am I not finding a new job? For that question, I heard over and over individualized answers of, at first, I think I may not be a good enough job seeker. I'm not networking well enough. I'm mm-hmm. not good at interviews. And then over time, typically 3-6 months into a job search, I started hearing, I'm starting to fear that there's something wrong with me, something that employers detect in interviews, something that comes across that really some kind of flaw that is keeping me from getting jobs. So the fact that we're able to both provide a structural narrative talking about the economy and outsourcing, and also in other cases, an individual narrative, there's something about me, I think calls for an explanation for why one type of narrative is seen in one context and another in the context of job search. I think there's something specific about job search that leads to this self of it's all about me and taking it very personally. And in the book, I link it to the way in which white-collar workers need to look for work, the hiring system. I think is principally the cause of this sense of self-blame.
Well, the jobs, for one thing, aren't out there. I mean, that there's more people looking for jobs than there are jobs, and there's some truth to their assessment. That is that there's a situation now that I'm sure you're aware of where employers will not hire anyone who is unemployed. They say, you know, because if there were layoffs at a firm, they know that the majority of people are still working. Somehow you, the unemployed, the laid off, were dispensable or weren't the highest quality. They kept they shrunk down the workforce. They kept the best people. And so there's lots of employers that just say, we're not hiring anyone that's unemployed. So there's actually that could I wouldn't say it's true, but that could affirm that sense.
Well, what you're pointing to is an incredibly important phenomenon, and which I think we're seeing increasing evidence of, that job seekers, particularly out of work more than 6 months, are getting systematically shut out simply due to the duration of unemployment. So a really important study recently done by a graduate student at Northeastern, Ran Gayad, sent resumes that were identical except for two things. One was how good a fit the person was in terms of their prior experience, and the other was the duration of unemployment. And he found overwhelmingly that job seekers with less experience were much more likely to get called back if they were not long-term unemployed, whereas those long, you know, more than 6 months unemployed with very relevant experience had almost no callbacks. So there's a real stigma, a real systematic shutting out of the job seeker. Now, going back to the question of flawed system, flawed self, this is a flawed system problem. This is a situation where nobody's evaluating your experience, your fit, your merits. There is a structural problem with how hiring is done and how job seekers are evaluated that is not, in this case, about anything that the job seeker is doing or not doing or their qualification for the job. And nonetheless, there is an overwhelming sense that there is, among the job seekers, that deep down it's me. And me not because I'm unemployed 6 months and there's a stigma, but me because there's something wrong with me. And this is the most devastating form of a loss of sense of self that happens in unemployment, which then creates a cycle of discouragement and less likelihood to continue job searching, meaning longer unemployment and even tougher time to get into the workforce. I think that the reason we see this repeatedly among American white-collar job seekers is that the job search process itself is so highly personalized. So if you're a job seeker, the central activity of your job search is networking. It's going out and trying to create rapport, develop relationships with friends of friends, with old acquaintances, with anyone who would be willing to talk to you. Essentially, it's a nonstop job because any interaction you have is a potential network opportunity. And what you're trying to do in this context is create some kind of connection, create a rapport so that the person will want to refer you. Mm-hmm. Job seekers understand that referrals happen not just because the person thinks you're qualified, but because they like you and they want to help you. This is exhausting work. And on top of it, it highly personalizes the outcome. So when you think, as most job seekers do, and probably rightly so, that networking and then how well they do in interviews is the key to getting a white-collar job, then when you're not getting those jobs, your interpretation of what the issue is focuses all about you and you personally. So I think it's unlikely that we're going to be able to change the hiring system and its strong reliance on referrals and networking. But I do think we can do a better job in supporting job seekers to develop more resilience and to understand their labor market outcomes, that the 6 months of rejections that many, many face, is something that's not only about them. What they may be doing could be a factor, but there's a lot of other factors like the ones you pointed to, the lack of jobs, the systematic screening out of unemployed job seekers, the stigma against unemployed job seekers. Having that broader understanding, a more sociological understanding, if you will, of the labor market and institutions that and barriers they're facing actually helps resilience. This is something I found in my Israeli case, where job seekers were much more clear on the obstacles they were facing. Those obstacles were much more transparent, in fact. And in that context, while they were angry about being unemployed, they felt better about it, but they continued job searching. We didn't see the same discouragement as in the United States, because the worst kind of discouragement comes when you think there's something wrong with me, Because about once you think that there's really nothing you can do about it, or you might feel like there's nothing you can do, it doesn't matter if the labor market's picking up. It doesn't matter if certain sector, maybe there's jobs in that sector, so you should try there. If it's about you, you're debilitated. If it's about the market and about external obstacles, then there is room for thinking about strategies for overcoming those obstacles.
Sure. The book is Flawed System, Flawed Self, Job Searching and Unemployment Experiences. My guest is Ofer Sharon. And you can go to his website. It's OFERSHARONE.com. And there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com as well. Well, you're certainly not saying that everyone could get a job if they had a sense of resilience. That's sort of the old mantra that one even heard during the Great Depression of the 1930s. As you just said, if the jobs aren't available, and what we keep hearing is that awful phrase, the new normal, where we're not going to have full employment, we're not going to have well-paying jobs for great numbers of the American workforce, people at least shouldn't be beating themselves up.
Yeah, of course, I'm not suggesting that everyone could get a job if they only job searched more resiliently. There is a macro problem of a shortage of jobs. We are, which requires social policy and government intervention to solve. What I'm addressing is the real crisis of having 4 million people systematically shut out of the labor market altogether. People that are becoming so discouraged that they're dropping out of the labor force and having marriages fall apart, in some cases becoming homeless, and the loss of hope and the devastation that comes with that is something that I think we could provide support for, so that no one group of the population is excluded out of the labor market. At the same time, that I agree, we do need to engage in other policies beyond supporting job seekers that will create more jobs and, mm-hmm. and more opportunities.
Well, you know, during the 1930s, there were what they called unemployed councils, and these were almost exclusively made up of industrial workers, but they were able to support one another, and they're within that, as you were saying, they understood that this was a problem, a macro problem, a large problem that they were just little pieces of, and it wasn't they who were the flawed person, but forces beyond them. And you talk some about self-help and flawed system, flawed self. I just kind of picked that out of the air. Somehow Americans are so individualistic at this point in our history that I can't imagine particularly white-collar workers forming unemployed councils. But what could we do, or what should people do other than say, hey, it's not my fault?
That's a great question. That's actually the question of my next research that is launching this week. So what we're doing to answer that question is I began talking with career coaches and counselors who are providing help to job seekers, but often job seekers who can afford to pay them, right? This is a service that costs money. And I said, you know, the people who need you most are the ones that can't afford to pay you. And I got a tremendous response of people saying, we would be willing to do it for free, to provide pro bono, if there was a way we could do it where we don't get overwhelmed by people who can't afford that we go out of business. And I said, well, how about if I do the matching for you and you let me track the outcomes so that we can see what's working better and what are the most promising strategies of support, and not only support to get a job, but also support for the kind of issues we've been talking about decreasing self-blame, helping people maintain resilience and a healthy sense of self, whether it's group support or one-on-one support. So this idea took off this summer, largely with the help of a Detroit native, Michelle Rosen, who I met while she was at Wellesley here. She worked for me as a research assistant, and a recent grad of Wellesley. She had the energy to put together with me an Institute for Career Transitions, where we've recruited now over 40 career coaches and counselors who volunteer their time. And next week, we will begin to match them with long-term unemployed job seekers to see which strategies are working best. And our hope is, in fact, to replicate this in the Detroit area. We've talked with JVS in Detroit, Jewish Vocational Services.
Sure.
We understand that, this crisis is certainly as big and probably bigger in Detroit than it is in Boston. And this is meant to all provide some answers about what is the best way to support people who have been out of work for more than 6 months, support them both in terms of how can they get around the very real barriers that exist, but also support them in continuing to have a sense that this is not their fault, that they're living in an economy which is in crisis, which is not producing enough jobs, and this means they must keep going and must try to find jobs despite the fact that this is not their fault.
I think this is all wonderful. Here's my concern. If I was unemployed, and the easiest person in the world to fool is yourself, but I would think that I would be a good job candidate, and probably could get employment again if I was to lose this particular job. But it's a buyer's market, so they can ask for the brightest and the best. But when there's a great need for labor, when unemployment goes way down and everybody almost gets hired that wants to. But in this situation, what about the person that's not very bright, that actually doesn't have the greatest skills, that in many ways is superfluous? I mean, maybe that's not the what we're talking about here, and that's more the larger structural problems. But I think that what you're suggesting is wonderful and an incredible service, particularly to our area here in Detroit. But so is this what I'm talking about, when we talk about a flawed system, I'm talking about the larger economic system. Is that outside of the purview of this book?
It's not outside the purview of this book and the new research, in that from the individual's perspective, having an understanding of the very flawed system that we have is very important in order to know how to navigate that system. Flawed though it may be, we need to be working at two levels. We need to be working to change the system. We need to create more jobs. We need to create more transparent and fair hiring systems. And at the same time, we also need to support individuals who are currently stuck in this flawed system and needing support for support in various forms. Financial support, it's essential to maintain a strong safety net, to continue extending unemployment compensation. Support in terms of advice on how to navigate this very tricky job market that's targeted at the obstacles faced by this group. So we have a lot of generalized job search advice, books and books, in any store or on Amazon, but very few advice books that are targeted at this particular group. They're probably not the greatest consumers of books because of limited budgets, but they probably needed the most advice on what do you do when you're systematically screened out? What are the alternative ways to speak to a hiring manager? How to find the under-the-radar kinds of jobs that filter and screen in different ways. This is, and we need this kind of advice targeted to this group because they are in crisis.
Are you with me? Well, dear friends, I seem to have lost my guest. I have no idea what just happened. But I think what we're going to do, since we're almost at the timed end of it, rather than trying to do this all over again, edited. I guess I can just say that it's been good talking with Ofer Sharon. The name of the book is Flawed System, Flawed Self, Job Searching and Unemployment Experiences. It's published by the University of Chicago Press, and I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And if you ever want to get a hold of me, it's pretty easy. It's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. So after I click the button and stop this recording, I'm going to call my guest, Ofer Sharon, and say, what happened? I'll let you know next week. All right, thank you for listening, and we'll do it again.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Hey, music lovers. Tired of your music buffering while you're running around? Here's a reality check. Verizon's 4G LTE is the most reliable and in more places than any other 4G network. Reliability you can believe in. That's powerful. Verizon. Click on the banner to compare the maps.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
101 WRIF, everything that rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bring that moment of freak out.
Everything that rocks.
We'll be right back.
to know about sacrifice. When the lights go out, the price you pay when you're digging down. Skin your teeth and a pain in your back. What you know about hope? What you know about that?
WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, that's good to know.